from the high desert and the great American Southwest. How did you all? Good evening and or good morning and welcome to the program, which I'm going to try to get underway quick because we have a lot to do. I'm Art Bell, and from Guam in the west to the U.S. Virgin Islands in the east, south into South America, north all the way to the pole and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Art Bell. I'd like to welcome right up front a new radio station, KDGO in Durango, Colorado. 1240 on the dial there. Welcome to the network. Glad to have you along for the ride. And oh my, a ride it's going to be. How many of you saw the moon show? Questioning whether we ever went to the moon at all. They said why they believe the whole thing was staged here in the high desert, they said. At Area 51, they said, and gave a whole litany of reasons and some fairly convincing video evidence that my pixel people out there, when picking apart UFO photographs, would have, I'm telling you, they'd have a field day with some of this stuff. It was fairly convincing. I have always laughed at the notion that we never went to the moon. I still think we went to the moon, but no more ha-ha-ha. I'm a little concerned at some of what I saw, and I would imagine many of you who saw it also would have some concerns. In a moment, we'll explore all of that. Richard C. Hoagland, a one-time advisor to NASA and sidekick for Walter Cronkite, and science advisor, actually, and author, and many other things will be here. But so will Wayne Green, who has staunchly, over the years, always said we never went to the moon, to which I've always replied, ha, ha, ha. We'll see. Oh, that'll be appropriate for what we're going to do right now. As I said, the program at least wiped the smile and took away the snicker from my face. Here is Richard C. Hoagland. Hi, Richard. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. I'm having a real flash of deja vu here.
God, it's great to have you back on.
It's great to be back on with you running the helm.
Oh, well, thank you. All right, Richard, I know that you saw the program on Fox tonight, too.
Yes, in detail. Taped it.
Yeah, good, so did I. I've got to say, as I said, it took the smile off my face, Richard. The crosshatch marks, there were just, I'd love to take things kind of point by point, but, you know, they made a fairly good case that we never went to the moon. That the whole damn thing was staged.
Well, the thing that impressed me, first of all, was that Fox would actually put a program like this on the air,
yeah,
on the network.
Even going way out on a limb and virtually almost accusing murder. I mean, well, that's...
Yeah, when they got to the Grissom part, I must say that there were overtones of some of our own investigation. But let's look at the big picture. This is now 2001. It's the spring of 2001. We are coming up the, you know, Steve Bass's disclosure curve. Something is coming down the road a few months from now. I absolutely can feel it in my bones that something big is going to break.
Well, we've been thinking that, though, for a long, long time.
Well, we will see. I mean,
yeah,
time
we'll
will tell.
You're right. You're right.
Year.
We'll see.
Well, if that was going to happen, what you have to do is to get certain people in the agency in NASA who have been sitting on extraordinary evidence of ruins on the moon and on Mars, God knows where else, out of the hot seat. And the way you do that politically is you put up a straw man conspiracy, which is so easily disassembled and deconstructed. And then, you know, you watch, Fox will have a part two. And we'll have a vigorous rebuttal of what we saw tonight.
Well, they probably ought to, because the rebuttal they had on tonight with the NASA guy wasn't worth a hoot.
Well, it didn't take point by point by point, which I intend to do. And by the way, on the Enterprise Mission website, we have a detailed refutation of the whole moon hoax idea.
Is it up there now?
It's up there now.
All right. We've got a link on our site right by Richard Hoagland's name.
Who Mourns for Apollo.
And it's a point by point.
A point by point. We missed a couple things, like the crosshatches on the photographs we didn't get in. But Mike Barra and I were working, you know, for the last several days knowing this was coming. We wanted to get something very substantive up. And we're going to do a series of articles in the next few days.
Well, that's fine. But, Richard, you missed the most important thing, in my estimation, of all they talked about, and we'll get to some of the other stuff, the crosshairs that were etched in the camera lenses. I mean, look, Richard, let's settle. Let you and I settle on one thing. Were those faked pictures, yes or no?
Oh, I think they were faked, yes.
You think they were faked?
Well, let's say they were altered. Faked is different from altered.
Okay, it occurred to me maybe the crosshatch that was supposed to be across the American flag was removed so you could see the American flag.
You got to go to the PR department because the sequence of these images and the model that we went to the moon is you take film of the moon, puts it in the cameras of astronauts, they take pictures.
Yep.
Film comes back to an aircraft carrier in the middle of the Pacific,
yes.
Picked up, is flown to Houston, went to the NASA Photographic Laboratory run by a guy named Dick Underwood in Houston.
Yeah, and what is done there?
And then prints were prepared because the originals were not prints. They were slides, ektachrome-type slides.
Okay, but at any stage from a snap to development, all I care about is, did they modify those photographs?
Well,
is that hard evidence they changed the photos?
Wait a minute. But then the sequence is that some of those prints and internegatives go over to the public affairs office.
Yes.
And they send them out to Life magazine, Time magazine. Remember, it was a lot of print back then because television was not as big as it is now. So they were preparing hard copy for the print media, basically color magazines like Life. The guys who were preparing those prints for press distribution were not technical. They weren't scientists. They weren't engineers. They were PR people.
Yeah, I've got that.
And since Ken Johnston reports that he actually saw airbrushing of photographs, it is reasonable on the model that we went to the moon and that these photographs were altered for cosmetic purposes so that the little cross didn't cross the American flag. But would you have to look at how NASA's PR was running in those years, and they wanted nothing but pristine National Geographic-type pictures for their best astronaut images.
That's the only reason I could imagine they would alter those photographs.
There's one other reason. And the other reason is the investigation we've been conducting for the last, 10 years or so, which is that NASA went to the moon, found stunning stuff, and they had to hide what they found.
So in other words, your position is you think the photos are fake. You agree with that?
No. I said altered. Difference between fake and altered.
Okay.
Altered,
all right. Then your position is we did go to the moon.
Yep.
But you think they were altered for A, cosmetic reasons, and B, to take out all the signs of prior...
No. I think these alterations, which are so stupid, were deliberately done in the same vein that you're now a series of books put out by the astronauts that have some very bizarre pictures in them.
Yes.
That are first-person accounts, which we look at as whistleblowing.
Yes.
We've never done a show following the Collier debate that I did in 97 as to what has happened since this has all hit the fan, since the idea that we found ruins and NASA's covered them up on the lunar surface
has been
in public domain.
So, Richard, you believe that the ruins that they found were airbrushed out just the way the crosshair on the flag or the crosshair on the piece of equipment was airbrushed out. All right. I want to bring on with us...
I
want to bring on somebody else. Wayne Green has been, for years now, he's been telling me we never went to the moon. Right, Wayne?
Well, I think I've mentioned it a few times, right?
A few times. And I've always laughed at you.
Hi, Wayne.
Hi there.
So let's discuss this crosshair thing a little bit. Wayne, did you hear what he just said? He thinks, yeah, they were altered. He agrees. I mean,
no question, because physically the way those little reticles, which are what the crosses are called, were on an aluminized plate at the back of the Hasselblad. So the light came in the lens, went through the plate, and struck the film. And the idea was to put the crosses on for calibration. Well, there's no way with that geometry you can get an object on the lunar surface photographed with a cross behind it. It had to have been altered on the Earth in the darkroom.
So airbrushed. You're saying airbrushed.
Airbrush is a general term. This required a much more precise technique.
Wayne, you agree with that. I mean, the evidence was, I think, overwhelming to even the average person that obviously the photographs have been changed.
Well, photographs. They showed what, two or three?
Yeah,
I looked at hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. I have found two or three that were altered this way, and they're all photographs that have been published, not photographs that no one has ever seen before. The ones we got directly from NSDC, hundreds and hundreds, never have I seen an example of this. That photograph or two they showed were photos that appeared in, spreads in Life magazine and National Geographic.
All right, that's good enough. Wayne, do you have any answer for that?
Oh, I was kind of disappointed in the program in some ways.
Why?
But I thought that particular part made good sense.
That's a good question. Why were you disappointed?
Well, they didn't make much of a fuss over the lack of stars in any of the photos, even the photos supposedly taken of the Earth.
Yeah, but Wayne, that is a ridiculous argument.
Okay.
Put this to rest once and for all. Right?
Yeah, well, put it to rest, Richard.
Okay. Wayne, do you know anything about stellar and photographic magnitudes?
Yes.
Okay. You know that there's a scale of numbers,
mm-hmm.
and you can put brightness of celestial objects on this scale and rank them in terms of brightness. On this scale, for instance, the sun is minus 27. The moon is about minus 13. Sirius, the brightest star in the sky, is about minus 1.4.
All right.
So if I'm taking a picture on a brightly lit surface, the moon, even though the sky is inky black and there's no atmosphere, the stars are so damn dim by literally factors of millions, and I'll go through the numbers if you want me to, Art.
No, you know what? Stop, Richard.
But there's no way you can take a simultaneous picture.
Stop right there. Look, I've got modern equipment. I've got high-sensitivity CCD camera hooked up to a third-generation night vision in order to see the stars. I agree with that. If you should go out and shoot the moon at night, even with a good new camera, you're damn well not going to get stars, even now, here on Earth.
Yeah, and the photographs taken by the astronauts were taken on the day. They were taken with a bright, sunlit landscape.
Wayne?
Mm-hmm.
So?
Yeah?
I kind of agree with that.
Okay.
What about you?
What about the moon rocks? We did that on your program.
Oh, well, that's
a fellow called in who
so we left the stars now.
Yeah, we're just with the stars. I mean, do you generally agree with that assessment of the way a camera would have operated? Certainly then, and even now.
Well, the testimony that I've heard from the astronauts in near space say that the stars are incredibly bright once you're outside of our atmosphere.
Yeah, that's to your eye, though, and they certainly would be. If you included an object, if you included an object like the moon, which would be very bright, then you wouldn't see the stars.
You're on a bright, sun-drenched surface, even though it's the moon, and the fact that there's a black sky is what fools all of these amateurs who have never taken a picture into not understanding the simple physics that you cannot take with a small latitude film, which the color film was. You cannot take a picture simultaneously of a very, very, very dim object, a star, and a very bright object, a sun-drenched landscape,
all right,
have the two come out.
All right, let's leave that. Let's go ahead and leave that.
That is the key reason for most of these websites and most of the argument, that there are no stars on the moon, and it's a stupid argument.
All right, it's a stupid argument. All right, let's move on to another one. What about
the
shadows?
Well, remember, Wayne, I was Walter Cronkite's science advisor.
Right.
I lived every single microsecond of all these missions. I literally sat surrounded by 42, 45, 100 monitors. I was, there were my colleagues who said that I never goes home, and it was because it was the experience of a lifetime.
But Richard, they made the same argument you did. They said 99.9% of NASA would never have known.
Yeah, but I'm not NASA, and it's now 30 years in hindsight, and I was there, and I'm here now, and I've looked and analyzed with a team of experts, ranging from geologists to ex-NASA people to photographic people. And I can say, absolutely, we went to the moon, NASA covered up extraordinary discoveries, and this moon hoax nonsense is a blind alley. It is a wonderful diversion.
All right, here's another one. Let's take them as much as we can, point by point. I thought the shadows were very convincing.
No,
the
shadow argument is stupid, because it implies that the lunar surface is as flat as a billiard table. In fact, the lunar surface is as hummocky and as lumpy and as rolling as any landscape you'd find on Earth. And if you have two rocks sitting on two different levels on a hummocky surface, the shadows will not be parallel.
All right, Wayne.
And on our website, you will see demonstrations, examples of photographs where that geometry obtains.
Okay, fair enough. Wayne, do you have any argument on the shadows?
Oh, sure. I found it interesting when the two shadows of the, Aldrin and the other chap there crossed each other. But more interesting was that the shadows taken with the sun higher on the Apollo 11 trip, where the sun was much higher, were much longer than the shadows on the previous trip when the shadows were shorter.
Richard?
Well, the only mission we ever landed first was Apollo 11.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first mission on the surface, and the sun angle was about 11 degrees.
Right.
There was no previous mission.
Okay.
The previous mission was Apollo 10, which did not land, was prohibited from landing. The mission before that was Apollo 8,
mm-hmm.
which did not land, went into
okay.
orbit. So the first landing, and they only stayed about 20-some hours, which was, you know, less than one Earth day, and the moon, the sun moves because of lunar rotation,
mm-hmm.
about 13 degrees per day, so it was higher on the second day than the first day, but there were no pictures taken outside on the second day because the lunar EVA was done the night of the first landing.
Mm-hmm.
And they left the next morning.
Yeah, have you read,
Do the Wild Thing at 775-727-1295.
For MI6. Shall we continue?
No, you may stop right there. Let's move on to...
Well, I think, according to the chap from NASA that was on there,
yeah,
I'm
Brian
not
Well,
then.
Who's a PR guy.
Do you both agree the chap from NASA, as you put it, didn't do such a hot job?
Well, he didn't have editing time. In other words, you don't know what was on the cutting room floor, what kind of evidence, what kind of specific refutation.
That's
the
true.
Way this was edited was definitely overwhelmingly one-sided.
Okay. Here's a point I thought was very well made, and that was the radiation. That, in fact, during one of the missions, we had one of the largest sun eruptions we would ever have. And it would have excited the Van Allen belt to the point that they would have been cinders, virtually. And there's been nothing. They haven't, no ill health, no problems.
How did the film get through that?
These are good questions. It was a wafer-thin covering, and they showed it, almost aluminum foil. Certainly not, you know, inches of lead or anything like that, or 3 feet of lead, Richard.
Okay, on the Enterprise website, as part of our discussion of this, we have a technical document from NASA called Technical Notes TND 7080, Apollo Experience Report, Protection Against Radiation, by Robert English, Richard Benson, Jay Bailey, C. Brown from the Manned Spacecraft Center in March of 1973.
Which says basically what?
Basically that it was a non-problem. And the reason was that the solar flare problem is separate from the Van Allen problem. The Van Allen belts, or high radiation belts trapped by the Earth's magnetic field, basically close around the Earth, about 25,000 miles out. The reason it was a non-problem is that we zipped through them in less than an hour at 25,000 miles per hour. And they counted, the NASA engineers counted on the speed of going through the radiation to minimize the overall dose, which was about one rad, if I remember the numbers correctly. When they came back from the moon, remember they're accelerating under Earth gravity.
Yes.
So they fell back through that radiation belt at very high speed and spent very little time. Radiation is not the amount of radiation, it's the amount of radiation times the exposure time.
Yes, oh yes, indeed, the totality of it.
Yeah.
That's an interesting argument.
And in terms of the Apollo 16 mission, that flare, I was in Houston during the flare, and if I remember correctly, there was very little concern because it wasn't really that big a deal. It was persistent. It was long over time, but the actual peak radiation, and I was charged with the Cronkite people to actually look into the radiation with some solar astronomers, and I got into a whole brouhaha with one guy who wanted to be on the air, and it was a whole ego thing, and it was very, very disturbing for me at the time. But I was vividly immersed in all that, and we were very lucky. During the entire Apollo experience, we didn't have a major flare that would have really killed them outright.
All right.
Now, there were two astronauts, if I remember correctly, who have died of cancer. Jack Schweigert from Apollo 13.
Yes.
Died of cancer.
All right, so there might have been an effect.
You've got long-term, you know, effects, and this was kind of the price of
the... All right, I'm with you, but the high point of your argument was we went through the belt very quickly.
Very quickly.
And sure, they got radiation, but not
and
enough
And the film,
do...
let me get to the film.
Well, this
is the thing that I know most about that I've never talked about.
The film, all right.
Everybody who's written about this, and I don't know whether, Wayne, you've been involved in this, but nobody seems to realize that NASA issued a special top-secret contract to EG&G back in the mid-60s, in 65,
yes,
to develop an extraordinary color film to take to the moon. And I was personal friends with the inventor, the developer of that film, who was a man named Charlie Wyckoff, who was the chief film guy at EG&G in Boston.
Can we get that film today?
You can get a version of it from Kodak.
All right.
To finally put a version on the market.
All right. Wayne, are you aware of that?
No, I was going by the information from the Percy book, which said that they looked into the film thing very carefully.
No, they didn't.
Well, that's what they say.
Yeah, but he's an agent. Come on, guys.
I don't know that he's an agent.
It makes it very interesting. What is Percy and his colleagues' agenda in writing that
book? All right,
book?
Gentlemen, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll come back and we'll do more. Thought I'd use Maggie to keep it short because we don't really want calls right now. I'm going to get back into this as quickly as I can. Richard C. Hoagland and Wayne Green are here. We'll be right back. Ooh, that wasn't the Thunderbolt. That's the garbage cans. Oh, well, here we go.
Well, it's very appropriate because this is garbage.
Garbage.
We went to the moon, guys.
All right, the film. Any further comments, Wayne? I mean, he's saying that this kind of film existed then and exists now. You disagree?
I don't have any further information other than that, what was it, M3 agent?
MI6.
I love that.
MI6.
Yeah. No, look, anyway. This film, I mean, I fell into something extraordinary at a very tender age. I was, what, 23, 24 back then? And I was given roles of this incredible super film, and Charlie told me to go around and take as many pictures under most bizarre conditions I could think of that, mm-hmm. that were possible,
mm-hmm.
which included, you know, looking directly into the sun and photographing detail and deep shadows. You can't do that with a normal film. And then I would take it back to EG&G, and he would develop it. I took some to the Cape, and I actually photographed the liftoff of Apollo 8 with this film because I wanted to test it and see if we could see detail in those incredible flame plumes from those five incredible engines.
Right.
I was able to then, at CBS expense, get a chopper to go from New York to Boston to the lab,
mm-hmm.
get the film developed, bring it back so we could put it on the air for Cronkite, and we could see the details of the nitrogen shock diamonds in the middle of the flame plume, while we also could see the crystal clear landscape of the Cape and the Saturn V and the blue sky and the seagulls and all
Well, all of that,
but
okay.
No stars.
All of that's great.
Well, no stars because there does happen to be scattering of the sky over the Cape during the time they launched these missions.
Wayne, what was the most important piece of evidence that we didn't go to the moon, in your view, that they didn't put on the show?
Well, of course, I had some extra information from one of my 73 magazine readers who was the head of their data processing in subsequent years.
Who said what?
And he said that he was looking through one of their closets there for some tape to use, and he found one and put it on, and it was the entire Apollo 11 trip. Only the tape was dated 5 months before the trip.
So you would think that would be the most important. You know, it's funny, Wayne, so many times I've heard you say, it couldn't have happened. The spacesuits could not have fit through the lamp,
right.
You know, the measurements and everything. I thought that would have been the most important convincing piece of evidence.
That's key. Also,
wait. Tell Ken Johnston that.
One of the things that they did not put on the show that I think would have been very compelling was a demonstration in a laboratory of what happens to dust when you evacuate all of the air. And it turns to like stone, and you can bounce a steel ball off of it, and you cannot make a footprint or a tire print. And tire prints...
You're saying the footprints...
I love the tire prints.
Okay, so you're saying the footprints and the tire prints could not have been.
Not on the... There shouldn't be any dust where there's no air or anything like that.
Richard?
Well, this is, again, incredibly controversial, and I've seen studies where they actually have duplicated the lunar surface conditions because you have ultraviolet, you have charging of the surface, you have particles that repel each other that don't cement in a vacuum the way we simplistically thought a few years ago. So you got to do a complete simulation, and that's a lot of money, and no one, frankly, wanted to pay all that money because they went to the moon. Let me go back to another point. We talked about the radiation problem.
Yes.
There was another astronaut who died of cancer, and I just remember when I went to get a cup of coffee during the break, and that was Alan Shepard. So you've got 12 guys that actually go down to the lunar surface. Two of those guys, you know, of the 18 that went into lunar orbit.
But Richard, the show, I hear you. I hear you. But the show made exactly the opposite point, saying that there were no overt problems at all.
No, but in the long term, 20, 30 years out, they died of cancer. This is the statistical.
That percentage of people are going to die of cancer.
One out of nine?
Just on the average.
What are the cancer statistics? I think I asked Collier this and he didn't know.
It's about 30%.
You mean in the end, people who...
In the end, right.
Yeah, okay. Well, maybe that's about right.
Less than 1%.
A lot of people die of cancer. Gentlemen, I'd like your own answer to this question, and short as possible. And the one,
here we are.
The one,
gosh, it's sounding familiar.
The one laughing knows who it's directed to. My question would be, and I think it's a good one, why the hell haven't we gone back to the moon? I mean, we've got water that may well be on the moon. I think they've just about conclusively proven that. We could actually have a base there. It is strange, is it not, that all these years have gone by and we haven't gone back to the moon?
I think this also helps explain why they're covering up what they've spotted on Mars. Because if they let it out that they've spotted artifacts there that need to be looked at more carefully, there's going to be a big outcry, oh, let's go send somebody up there to look at it, and they can't do it.
Richard?
Well, I have a very different take. I think we haven't gone back to the moon because we were shocked with what we found. We came back home with our tail between our legs, and they've been spending 50 years hovering in their Brookings closet trying to figure out how the hell to tell us that we're not living in a solar system the way they thought they were living in before we actually went on these various journeys.
So, in other words, Wayne thinks we haven't gone back because we never went in the first place, and you think we haven't gone back because they were so damn shocked at what they found.
Well, look at what happened on both sides of the Iron Curtain in the wake of the Apollo missions. The FBI, and this I have absolute sworn testimony from engineers that were part of the vast 400,000 infrastructure that built the Apollo program, the FBI went around to all the subcontractors, and anybody who had a key piece of the Saturn V, they took the blueprints and destroyed them so we could never build another vehicle to go to the moon. The Russians went even further. They literally took sledgehammers and acetylene torches to their boosters and their lunar vehicles, and there's only bits and pieces of scrap now left of
Richard,
the Soviet lunar program.
Okay, but Richard, why would the godless Soviets care one whit whether there were things on the moon that would destroy our paradigms and religious beliefs?
Well, because it's more than religion. It's economics, it's control issues, it's power, we were at the height of the Cold War, you know, I'm sure someday we will get declassified documents. We've actually had more from the KGB than we've had from our guys, indicating that there was a tremendous fear of what was found, and we basically came home in shock.
Okay, Wayne, why do you think all these things were so summarily destroyed?
I don't know. Other than they just knew that they couldn't get out there, and I don't think they had any other choice on it.
All right. This is for both of you. They postulated that all of this was done at Area 51. And, in fact, if you look at the area where I live, in Area 51, if you did it right, there is so little difference between what they showed of the landscape and so forth and what we have out here that it's pathetic. I mean, you could, I guess the question is for both of you, could it have been faked? Could it have been done at Area 51? Is that possible? I'm not asking you what you believe. I'm just asking you if it's possible, Richard.
Well, given enough money and enough secrecy, I suppose anything is, quote, possible.
Well, they had a lot of money.
Well, we had about $20 billion yeah. in the constant dollars in 69, which is about $40 billion now. So, yeah, you had a lot of money. I go back to all the little things we found on the actual evidence, the data that came back, which is evidence of lunar ruins taken by handheld Apollo astronauts using Hasselblad cameras. How do you explain that away? How do you explain the little things that were carefully placed almost in time capsules for some future generation to trip over and reconstruct what we really did discover on the lunar surface? This idea that it was done at Area 51 is fashionable because it's a place that, you know, no one even admits exists, and you can't get into it. You can't see what's there. The Soviets released some satellite imagery, which was very provocative, but that proves nothing. I mean, this show went to the height of lunacy, pun intended, of claiming there were breezes that were waving the flag.
Oh, yeah, the flag.
Obviously, the astronauts were vigorously trying to insert the damn pole in the ground, and they had one shot of the flag sitting there with no astronaut touching it, and it was absolutely motionless. I happen to know that the flag was a two-part affair. It was a bottom, you know, pole and then a top pole to fit it into it, and then the flag stuck out on a wire at right angles, a stiff wire, and when you wagged it back and forth because of inertia and lag, it made it look, if you were wiggling it, as if, yes, it was blowing in the breeze.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you, and here's another thing.
But
when
you do a show that puts up fake straw men and doesn't destroy the mock argument, it undercuts the validity and the seriousness of the entire operation.
Now, I've heard that argument about the flag many times, but I've looked at the videos very carefully.
So have I.
And
I looked at the live stuff when it was being done.
And I didn't see any way that that flag could wave the way it did.
Well, yeah, but Wayne, if there was a wire there and he was fitting one pole into mm-hmm. another, essentially, there would have been motion. And if it was a wire...
Well, some motion, yes. But you notice that the flag almost doubled up on itself at one time there.
That's because there's no air. There's no air resistance. You couldn't do it on Earth because you'd have air resistance.
Well, plus there's this, gentlemen. I mean, the traditional view was there's no air on Mars. So if you were faking the landing, that would be one detail you definitely would pay attention to. You wouldn't have the flag waving around in an airless environment if you faked it, would you?
No. Huh. Look, this is an argument which I think is going to be with us for as long as there are people who were born after the lunar landings or didn't pay much attention during the actual Apollo missions.
No, I believed them at the time.
I believe them too because I was there. I was close. I was as close as anybody who was a non-astronaut could get.
I believe them too. What about Mrs. Grisham?
What about who?
Mrs. Grisham.
Well, what happened on Apollo 1 is a totally different discussion. And to bring it in, as this show did, and make overtones that Grisham died because he was murdered because he was going to blow the whistle on the fake Apollo program. No, I think, and I said it on your show before, Betty and Grissom and her son said it, that we have evidence, independent evidence, that yes, the astronauts were murdered, they were killed, but not to keep them from telling anything, but to kill the entire Apollo program. There were forces in this country at that point that didn't want us to go to the moon and didn't want to have the possibility of the confirmation with astronauts of what was photographed there by the surveyors and by the lunar orbiters. And they were trying to kill the entire Apollo program, and they came within a whisker of doing it.
All right, but Richard, in a way, you're putting forth your conspiracy theory and complaining about their conspiracy theory,
yeah,
but agreeing with them in substance.
Which is simpler, that you somehow convinced 400,000 people to participate in a $20 billion boondoggle that went nowhere, or that you actually spent all the money, went someplace, found something extraordinary, which only a handful of people could have seen, the astronauts and the guys in the film lab, and it died there.
The thing,
boys and girls, is we've got
Richard,
the film.
I have this old, naive belief that Americans working at NASA never, ever would have, for any reason, killed our own in such a tragic way.
Well, who said it was NASA employees?
I can't believe it.
Who said it was NASA employees?
Well, I mean, they were the ones in control of every bit of equipment.
Not really. The security around Apollo and around all the unmanned missions is so incredibly lax. I mean, yeah, we were in the Cold War, but it wasn't really taken seriously. And again, I was there. I went. I was able to get into places that you could never, you know.
I appreciate that.
With just a network credential,
yeah,
I could get into places that you shouldn't have gotten into.
I can believe that. Wayne, you have any comment on the whole Grisham thing to fire?
I just keep hearing the opposite story at every turn. This fellow that worked on the LEM said that he didn't believe that one person that worked at that company believed for 1 minute that we ever went to the moon. I talked to a fellow yesterday. He said that the daughter of the family next door had an uncle that was one of the astronauts, and he said, no, we never went there. So forth. And I just keep hearing this from everywhere, and every bit of evidence adds up. If it looks like a duck, if it walks like a duck, and it tastes like it.
It doesn't add up. Show me a piece of evidence that adds up. This whole stars thing, you just dropped it. You went on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
It is the key argument. Oh, we didn't go to the moon because the moon photographs don't show stars. It's an insane, stupid argument.
Well, okay, but...
Okay, so I'm insane and stupid.
But
no, the argument is insane and stupid. What is your position?
According to the fellow from NASA, anybody who doesn't believe that we went to the moon is a nut.
Yeah, he did say that.
But that was his only answer. He didn't answer any of the other arguments.
I think that you and Richard both agree.
How do you explain away the fact that photographic film, certainly circa 1969, could not take short exposure showing the lunar surface well focused and well lit and show stars in the same frame? It just physically could not happen.
And how could you get that film, that sensitive film, through the Van Allen belt without fogging
it? You're mistaking two arguments. Forget the sensitive film. The film, by the way, was radiation hardened. I'm going to put up on the Enterprise website a series of articles on this. It is so outrageous. And I told Mike Barr when we put up tonight's piece, I said, one piece is not going to do it. This has been a 30-year story building. Do you know where I first ran into this story, Wayne? When I was with CBS, with the network, and had carte blanche to go anywhere in NASA, and they actually liked me.
Mm-hmm.
I went from Rockwell, where we had built a whole solar system, to walk people through during the Apollo 11 landing. And a few days later, we put everything together, hundreds and hundreds of tons of gear, and went up to JPL in Pasadena. I walked in the door, and one of the PR people for JPL was squiring around a guy who was handing out leaflets claiming that the Apollo 11 experience, which was a week and a half old, never happened. It was a fake in a hangar somewhere in Nevada. That is how old this story is, and why he was being given red carpet treatment by NASA personnel themselves is a mystery that I now look back on and say, why the hell didn't I ask that question then?
Wayne?
Yeah. Okay.
So in other words, Wayne, you're willing to do, you've got a good open mind, I know you do, and you're willing to look at evidence point by point, are you not, that would suggest we did go to the moon?
I did not buy into this conspiracy theory easily. It took quite a bit of convincing and quite a lot of evidence, and as I say, backed up by the information from one of my readers, backed up by this fellow that was down in Antarctica that sent up the rocket.
One of your readers?
Hmm? Yeah.
One of your readers, One Swallow Makes a Summer?
This fellow was the head of information technology at NASA a couple of years later. He did a thesis on Apollo 11, so he was very familiar with it.
And in his thesis, did he claim that it didn't exist, it didn't happen?
No, not at all. His thesis, he believed it. And then he saw this tape, which was automatically dated by the computers.
Have you seen a copy?
Yeah, that should have been on the show. I mean, where is
that tape exists?
Where's the meat? Where's the tape?
Yeah.
Where is the tape?
Yep.
See,
I don't believe he stole the tape.
Okay.
In my conspiracy theory, guys, in my conspiracy theory, NASA itself has been spreading and fostering this rumor.
Well, there we go.
Well, no, wait a minute. Here's my evidence. I walk into JPL and they're giving the red carpet treatment to the guy handing out leaflets claiming it was the most bizarre thing you could imagine. It made no sense, and I had no context back then. I was so stupidly naive, we all were, that I couldn't imagine that there would be a multi-level conspiracy so that down the road, when it came out of the closet that NASA had suppressed evidence of artifacts, they could claim, oh, we didn't do any suppression, any conspiracy. Look at this stupid nonsense that's been around for years that we never went. See how we destroyed that one?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting. There is one thing you both agree on. NASA lied. I mean, if I were to ask individually, Wayne, NASA lied, yes?
I believe so.
And Richard,
NASA lied.
And they're still lying.
And they're still lying, you say. So you both agree that NASA lied. You just have different conclusions about why.
Well, I don't think Wayne has actually looked at the evidence for the artifacts in specificity. He has had the time or maybe even the inclination.
Well, you know what? I'd like to have Wayne take a look at your point-by-point refutation on the website.
Yeah.
And then the next time I have Wayne on, which will be shortly, I'll ask him about that. And the next
time I'll be glad to look at that.
Okay, wonderful.
Well, one of the things we have on the web is another piece, which kind of goes hand-in-hand with tonight's piece. Let me go back one here, give you the title. It's called Alan Bean Shows Us the True Colors of the Moon. The piece on the Fox thing is called Who Mourns for Apollo? And then there's a piece on Malin's, you know, New Mars Face, which we will not have time to talk about tonight. And then below that, on the Enterprise website, the Alan Bean Shows Us the True Colors of the Moon. Alan Bean has done a book, which was released, last year and a half or so.
There's not going to be time for this.
Of his painting.
Let's just suffice to say, people can go up and read it. And Wayne will go up and read it. And then I'm going to have Wayne on separately, and I'm going to have you on separately very soon, Richard. And we'll have lots more time to do all of this. I want to thank both of you for... You do agree on one point, at least, gentlemen. Say goodnight.
Good night, Wayne.
Good night, Art. Glad you're back.
Thank you. All right. We'll pick that up in other shows. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM.
Inside the remaining sandwich, the sight of the touch or the scent of the sand or the scent of an oak roots deep in the ground. The wonder of flowers to be covered and then to burst up through tarmac to the sun again. Or to fly to the sun without burning a wing. To lie in the meadow and hear the grass sing. To have all these things in our memory and thoughts. And the use them to help.
Want to take a ride? Call Art Bell from west of the Rockies at 1-800-618-8255. East of the Rockies, 1-800-825-5033. First-time callers may reach Art at 1-775-727-1222. The wildcard line is open at 1-775-727-1295. And to call Art on the toll-free international line, call your AT&T operator and have them dial 800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell from the Kingdom of Nine.
All right. Let me get a couple of things out of the way. We just had a spectacular hour with Richard C. Hoagland and Wayne Green on the Did We Go to the Moon show. I've instructed the network to play that back as the first hour after the show. When we go into playback, they'll start with the first hour. So if you missed it, don't miss it, given a second opportunity. That was a wild hour. We'll do more on it. It was a wild show. Now, for the record, I still think we went to the moon. Although I must admit that I cling to these beliefs a little more tenuously than before. It wiped the smile off my face a little bit. Very interesting program. Very interesting indeed. Coming up in a moment, it's my favorite subject of them all. Frankly, it's time travel, and we've got somebody who's doing the real research, the hardware research. He's amazing. He's Dr. David Anderson. I had him on shortly before I left last April, and think you're going to want to hear what he has to say, and we'll catch up on what he's done. All of that immediately ahead, but rest assured, my friend, that that first hour is going to be repeated as soon as we get into repeat at the end of the program. Oh, one more thing. I've had enough fun with you, I guess, on the webcam. That photograph on the webcam site where you would normally see me live. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll give you 15 minutes to look at it on the website, and then I'll turn on the webcam again. But I thought I'd just leave it up there for shock value. Some listener sent it after the program. I called Keith, said, hey, why don't we put it up there where the webcam would normally be? And he said, yeah, that'd be fun. So if you want to see it, go ahead and see it. In 15 minutes, it'll be gone, and the live, real me will be there. Now comes Dr. David Anderson. He is a former United States Air Force officer, scientist, and flight test engineer, founder of a company called the Time Travel Research Center. This company has pioneered the development of a time warped field technology. Did you hear me? Pioneered the development of a time warped field technology that is demonstrating that real time control is much closer than most of us realize. His company and research association are dedicated exclusively to advancing the science, technology, and research that will deliver practical time control for us all. Dr. Anderson, his most recent publication is a brand new video called Time Travel, Journeys into Time. Ha-ha. This video traces the complete history of our views on time and time travel, from the ancient views of time to the latest groundbreaking technologies that are ready to change our world in the most exciting ways you can imagine. Here is Dr. David Anderson. Doctor, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Art. It's good to be here, and it's great to have you back on the air.
Thank you. For grins here, because that's about all that are left after the program tonight, I take it you heard at least a portion of the first hour.
Yes, I did.
Where do you come down in all of that? Where do you think there is any sort of reasonable evidence that we did not go to the moon? What do you think?
No, you're gonna put me on the spot here.
Yeah, sure. That's what I do for a living.
Well, you know what's interesting? The only way I can answer that question is that it's kind of the same way I look at my life now. Even though my background is in hard science and physics and mathematics, I've learned that by opening up my mind to any possibility that has plausible scientific foundation, that
right.
You can learn a lot. So I certainly wouldn't exclude anything your guests were saying, and I think it's worth listening to.
That was a good answer. That was almost like the guy from NASA. All right. Doctor, there is probably nothing I'm more interested in, and I'm not even sure why, than time travel. It has always been a core, a really, really core fascination for me, if we could travel in time. You know, I had a remote viewer on the other night, Ed Dames, who suggested that, there has been intervention, here on this planet, that, the intervention has been done by those things that we know as UFOs, but not manned by aliens. He said, interestingly, rather manned by men. Not exactly humans as we know them now, but humans from the future who have reached back to try and fix the balance of power by sabotaging a couple of programs that would have upset the balance of power and keeping us from destroying ourselves. If time travel ever does become a reality, and I know probably you can argue, gosh, it already is, Art, and we'll get to that part, but would something like that kind of manipulation, do you think the nature of time would allow that sort of manipulation?
I think the answer is that absolutely yes. I mean, there's nothing within our laws of mathematics and physics that would preclude that from being a possibility. And also, you look at the evidence. Not only our legend, but our legend and folklore are filled with stories about UFO sightings and contacts with aliens from other worlds.
Yes.
By kings, princes, doctors, lawyers, common everyday people. And it could be very possible that these stories are not about time travelers from a distant world, but instead that they're from our own future. And you look at the sightings, many of the creatures that have many human characteristics, maybe they're time travelers from our own planet visiting us from years ahead in the future.
Well, in my mind, if time travel ever can be, or is going to be, then the obvious question, I forget who it was, some famous person said, well, then where are the time travelers? And the answer might be, gosh, we're taking pictures of them all the time. I've got a very startling recent UFO photograph, things that blink in and blink out. They don't just always zoom away. Sometimes they virtually disappear. Who's to say these are not visitors from our own future?
Yeah, that's a very famous, it was by Stephen Hawking, the British physicist. And it was called his chronology protection conjecture. If time travel is possible,
where are they?
Where are all the time travelers from the future? And he actually presented that almost as scientific evidence because of the lack of visitors. But you're right, absolutely. There is much evidence that, these alien sightings are perhaps time travelers from our own distant future.
Where are the time travelers? They're right here, and occasionally we even get photographs.
Yeah. There's another commonly held belief, too, now in the scientific community that possibly, you know, any physicist will tell you that time travel may be very, very difficult, but it certainly doesn't violate the laws of our math and physics. The work we're doing, the work we've seen by Dr. Wang from NEC within the last year in superluminal light propagation shows that this is possible.
A good example is Dr. Michio Kaku. He's one of our nation's foremost theoretical physicists.
Yes.
And he agrees that time travel may well be possible, but then he talks about the power that would be required to achieve it, and putting things in perspective, he's suggesting we would have to be in control of the power of a sun, or even greater power, in order to actually, bend time, or to go back in time, or forward in time, that we could do it when we get to that level. I take it you have issue with that.
When all boils down to being said and done with our research, we can talk about it. We can talk about the applications, the technology. Excuse me. But what our great accomplishment is that we've found a way to create a time dilation at a much lower energy level. That is the bottom line foundation of our entire research.
A time dilation at a much lower energy level. All right, let's hit it one at a time. When you define the term time dilation,
essentially meaning that the rate at which time passes can be sped up or slowed down is probably the simplest way to put it.
Time can be sped up or slowed down.
Correct.
Effectively resulting in time travel.
Eventually, yes. I mean, right now what we're doing is we can create a small self-contained, what we call time warp field. And within that field, we can accelerate the rate at which time passes or slow down the rate at which time passes relative to the time rate outside of the field.
How do you know you're doing that?
Beginning about 3 years ago, we brought our first, what we call our time warp field generators online. Initially, in our first years, in 1997, we did work with both mechanical and electrical clocks, and we demonstrated the time dilation effect. In 1998 was a big year for us because we did our first test on a living organism. We actually used a living plant organism, and we were able to accelerate and slow down the life cycles of that living plant organism.
So okay, again, one at a time here. You just used a term, time warp field generator.
Yes.
What is that, pray tell?
Well, essentially, the theory that we introduced, it's a theory I introduced back in 1988. It's called time warp field theory. It's a discussion, an approach, and a technique that allows the creation of a field that will allow you to accelerate or slow down the rate at which time passes. The generator that we use to create that field is called a time warp field generator.
And by what means does it do that? In other words, what kind of field? Are you generating... I'm going to just take a stab in the dark here. Some sort of electromagnetic field. Is electromagnetics, or can you not talk about this?
No, I can talk about certain characteristics of it.
Alright, is electromagnetic energy involved?
Yes, it is.
I knew it. I knew it. I must tell you, I did a program last night in which I started getting these calls, Doctor, from people who had, you didn't hear last night's show, did you?
No, I didn't.
Okay, people who have had MRIs. You know what an MRI is, right?
Yes, I do.
Incredibly large electromagnetic fields. And I started getting calls, Doctor, from people saying, you know, I saw things, technicians who would say, I saw things, entities, whatever you want to call them, and I've seen them for years working around MRI. And I would never talk to my associates about this, and a couple did, and they were told, just shut up, keep your job, you know. But I've always thought that very large electromagnetic fields, since we're electromagnetic beings after all, might distort something in a near field and allow something to be seen. Now, I realize that's pretty far out, but it relates in a way to what you're doing, because what you're doing also is electromagnetic. So does that sound so wild to you?
It's difficult to say. Does it sound so wild? Maybe not. I mean, in our application, we use electromagnetics, but not necessarily in the same way that many people might expect us to say. I mean, our generator is very similar to, I guess, what I'd call a plasma generator, more of like a plasma generator that people would be familiar with in a high-energy physics experiment.
So you're saying you use an electromagnetic field to contain plasma?
Well, actually, that's pretty close. We have an antenna that induces what we call a high-speed rotational magnetic field, electromagnetic field in the core. Then we have an injector system that establishes a special environment, and then we use a high-energy laser array to induce the time warp field. So there is an electromagnetic component, but it's not. When we talk about time control technology, we quickly move to the Montauk Project.
Betcha. I was going to just stop you right there, and I was going to say, do you realize what you just described is so close to what I've interviewed people supposedly involved in the Philadelphia experiment. They gave technical details, and they had large electromagnetic fields along with rotating RF fields. And that's starting to sound an awful like what you just said.
Actually, not completely. We do have a rotational electromagnetic field,
yeah.
But it is a minor part of what we do. A critical part of what we do is an injector system where we establish we induce a gas reagent into the core of our generator, and then we use a high energy laser array. That reagent in the laser array is really what initiates and controls the field. However, it cannot be initiated without the electromagnetic field. Once we open up a time warp field, that electromagnetic field, the rotating electromagnetic field we have, really tapers off. We use it for control, but it's not as important after the field is opened. As within the Philadelphia experiment and the stories of the Montauk Project, that was a key critical element.
But you don't necessarily rule out the possibility that in what was described in the Philadelphia experiment, or even in just very large electromagnetic fields, that anomalous things might be observed?
I certainly there's scientific plausibility for that. What's interesting, Art, is that in my background is 20 years as a military scientist, doing what I do, 20 years of background in mathematics and physics, but I learned recently, probably about 4 or 5 years ago, if we're going to be able to move forward with our research, we have to look at it, the information on time and time travel from many perspectives. And I've become familiar with many people all around the world, right here locally on Long Island, people like Peter Moon and Preston Nichols.
Mm-hmm.
You hear stories of the Montauk Project. Some of them are very extreme. Some of them have scientific plausibility. But what I've learned is that there is foundation in scientific plausibility in many of the stories about time and time travel, even outside of the mathematics and physics textbooks. I talk with people from the Federation of Daemonherr in Italy, a cult that is based, their whole life is based on the study and worship of time.
Well, I interviewed Al Bielek, and I will give this assessment. I don't know how much of the audience will agree or disagree, but in the early hours of the interview with Al Bielek, he described in great technical detail the magnetic fields, the rotating RF fields, how they did what they did on this ship, and what they were trying to achieve. And technically, it sounded sound. It sounded as though it were based in technical fact. Now, as the story continued and it reached the Montauk stage, I thought it began to get a little out there. But the early stages of what I heard about the Philadelphia experiment, they sounded technically pretty much correct, Doctor.
Yeah, there's a lot of information about technical information about the degaussing of ships that was, you know, these large electromagnetic coils that were put on the ships for maybe degaussing the ship to make them undetectable to mines.
That's right.
There's foundation in these stories, absolutely. And that one thing I've learned is that it's worthwhile to listen and to study and for everybody to make their own assessment, but don't close your mind to it because there is scientific plausibility in a lot of these.
All right. So a time warp field generator. You have these. You've built them. You're using them, right?
Yeah, we're actually on our third generation system right now.
Third generation. Yeah, a lot of people in this country go, what? I haven't heard of this kind of research. What the hell is he talking about? Third generation time warp field generator? Why isn't this in the headlines? Why isn't this on the evening news?
Well, you know what amazes me? Well, actually, in many ways it has. We've been published in many articles, many television shows around the world. You know, Art, I think it goes back to a comment you made earlier. You said that time travel was one of your favorite subjects. What I don't understand is why aren't more people asking this question? You know, forget what we do and the research that we've been doing for 15 or 20 years and what everybody else is doing around the world. I mean, people, you know, it's my favorite dialogue is people ask what time is. Well, time is a really curious thing. If you ask anybody walking down the street if they know what time is, they're certainly going to immediately say yes, absolutely. But then, if you ask them to explain it to you, they'll be at a loss, loss for words. And I challenge all your listeners to try it with a friend, a family, a stranger in the street. And what's amazing to me, I don't understand why more people aren't asking this question about what time is. It dominates our whole language, our life, our culture. We use it in almost every other sentence that we utter every day, but we don't understand it.
Well, I'm lucky in this regard. I could ask a lot of people who probably are calling right now, but instead, I luckily have Dr. David Anderson here, who's building time warp field generators, and I can ask Dr. David Anderson, what is time? And that's exactly what I'm going to do when we get back. So prepare yourself, and I'm sure you are prepared for that. Can you imagine, folks, if you could fire back, say, to the Roman age, check out a little bit of the atmosphere, something like that? We may be able to. Time travel. Dr. David Anderson, who's really doing it and building things like time warp field generators. And trust me when I tell you, we're going to get back to that. But in a moment, we are going to talk about the nature of time. I guess it's pretty core to whether time travel is ever going to really be possible. Dr. David Anderson certainly says a big yes. All right. Once again, Dr. David Anderson, and I suppose a time-traveling obstetrician would say, first you have time dilation, then you have a full-grown adult popping out. Sorry. All right, Dr. Anderson, I think it is important that we cover the nature of time, what time is, because you must first understand that before you could ever hope to move through it, right?
I think that's true.
Okay.
My first reaction should be Mr. Art Bell is very glad you asked that question, and he's going to answer it now, because for as much as I've met people all around the world, I still have not had anybody give me a good definition of what is time.
Oh, no.
It is a fascinating question. But I'd certainly be glad to offer some insights, at least to...
give me your best shot.
Okay, well, you know, it obviously is a basic question to our conversation. You know, what is it that clocks are measuring? They seem to measure this unseen medium we call time that continues on with a never-stopping force, like that river that drags us along. We can't fight it, moving us through life to death. In some ways, last time we spoke, I talked about two of my favorite quotes. One of them is a quote, "Time is the fire in which we burn." That maybe says a little bit. Maybe we don't want to understand what time is. Maybe that's one of the reasons why we can't answer it, because it's so linked to our mortality.
No, I do want to know. I do want to know, and I want to even know about my own mortality and what may be beyond, if anything. And these two questions may coexist.
And maybe part of the answer is that time is a place where our rational minds bump into our own limitations. Maybe perhaps what we consider to be time, this medium, is somewhat like the ether we used to thought that permeated the universe. And maybe it's just something that's a product of our own biological and cultural evolution, maybe an illusion of our own mind.
Maybe it is. I've heard various references that make some sense. In the beginning, biblically, before there was anything, there really could not have been time, because there was no reference. In other words, if there was nothing, if there were not two bodies, planets or a sun and a planet or something, moving around the other, there was no reference of change. So, in a sense, there could not have been time. And so then once the Big Bang, which we won't bother to get involved with here, occurred, and there were objects traveling, moving away rapidly, there was a measurement that could be made. Yes?
Yes. As a matter of fact, there are many theories out there by reputable physicists that say time is a result of the expanding universe, or what we see as mechanical time anyway, as a result of the universe expanding.
Yes.
And that perhaps when it starts contracting, time will reverse itself.
Maybe it will, and things will start running illogically backwards. Is that what would occur if that happened?
I'm not sure if I agree with that, but there is, I mean, it is a worthwhile discussion point. There are many theories out there on the subject.
Okay.
But when you talk about time being illusion, you know, the way we look at time, again, is a function of our own mind and biological and cultural evolution. You look at, just within the United States, look at the history of the Navajo Indians. That seem to have many ties to many of these subjects. In their language, in their ancient language, there was no past, present, and future tense like other languages.
Right.
They always talked about events with regards to their quality of happening, not happening in the past or the future or someplace in time.
No, you're right.
It wasn't even a structure of their language.
You're absolutely right. I mean, now we even have this atomic clock in Boulder that helps all our other clocks stay dead on time. But what are we measuring? What are we really measuring? We've successfully invented this method, this clock. We look at it, it ticks, it's right or wrong, accurate or not, measured against something. But is it not really all our own invention?
You're absolutely right. It's probably, you know, in that case, there is a mechanical aspect to time. We like to be able to measure things. But what really is it that clocks are measuring? Now, you know, in some ways, time is a label we put on something we don't understand, much like gravity. You know, we could sit here and we could talk for hours about all the equations of gravity and the forces and all the formulas we have, but what they are representations of something we observe. It's not a definition of why is there gravity? Why are two objects attracted and pulled towards each other? We don't know the answer why. And time, in a way, is the same thing. It's a label we put on something to help make our lives a little bit easier.
Well, with respect to gravity, I always thought we were held on the planet because of its mass only. But I'm told by people like Professor Kaku that, no, we're actually here more because we're being pressed down on than we are held by the mass of Earth. So, you know, the experts are a little confused over this whole issue. They can't really... I've heard gravity defined in an awful lot of different ways by very knowledgeable people.
Yeah. You know what's interesting? When we talk about what is time, one of the most interesting people, you could talk about the views of Homer, Plato, Aristotle, but there was a philosopher, St. Augustine, and he was the first one, and it was right around, I think, 400, the year 400, and he the first one really to document and introduce time as an illusion of our own mind. And what's interesting is, when you look at what's happening in the new physics, in the world of quantum physics, mm-hmm. and you look at some of the things that are coming out of the particle accelerators and super colliders, they're more in tune with the views of the Navajo, the ancient Buddhist, Hindus, and Taoists that treated time as an illusion. Matter of fact, if you talk to somebody who's a master in the Buddhist religion, he'll look at you and he'll be confused as to why you think time moves. You know, they look at us and say, why do you think time moves? Time stays in its same place. The past, present, and future all exist at once. They're not separate.
I'm sure you've heard the expression, time is God's way of ensuring that everything doesn't happen at once.
Exactly. It's one of my favorite quotes.
Oh, is it? We have this thing, but you're suggesting you really believe, as they do, it's kind of an illusion.
I think I stick to the ground that that time is really still a place where irrational minds bump into their own limitation. It's a concept that's difficult for us to understand. It's amazing to me. We've known since the 1920s, the first scientific proof came in that time was not a constant. In the 1940s, it was proven over again 20, 30, 40 ways that, yes, time is changeable. You look at what's happened in the last 20 years. You look at Dr. Wang at the NEC who was able to inject a pulse into a cesium block and actually have it leave before it finished entering. Absolutely amazing. But how many people are walking down the street today fascinating with, you know, what is time?
Not enough.
Yeah, it's amazing. Maybe some ways we shrink all the magic in our world and our universe to the size of our daily routines and material possessions. I don't know. But it amazes me mostly that more people are not fascinated or asking the question, you know, what is time? You know, what really is it?
All right. That's probably as close as we're going to get. I mean, that's kind of a quick tour of a discussion of time. It doesn't mean that we understand it.
You know, exactly. I've asked the question everywhere, and I still am amazed. I think my favorite answer is somebody told me time is a sphere with wings. Sometimes the wings fly together and it moves forward. Sometimes they fly backwards and it flies backwards. And sometimes they just fly around in circles on itself and it doesn't move. So perhaps that's the best.
All right. You have constructed where did you come up with the idea or the design concept for a time warp field generator?
Well, actually, it was why I was doing work in the Air Force. My specialty at the time was space time physics navigation. Why I was a scientist in the Air Force, and we were trying to figure out why our satellites were drifting. I don't know if many of your listeners would know, but for probably about 30 years, there was a problem with satellites that were in orbit around the Earth, in that. We had the mathematical models that would show where the satellite should be, but at the end of every year, they were off by 1 or 2 or 3 meters.
And are you referring to, for example, the polar orbiters that could be tracked specifically, or the geosynchronous satellites, or all of them?
All of them. And it is anybody who's been involved in any satellite research, any astrophysics knows this, is that satellite positions, there was this mystery surrounding them that they knew every year that they were going to be off in position by 1 or 2 meters, and it was not due to error of equipment, it was due to some phenomenon we didn't understand. We created a mathematical model to help resolve the discrepancy, and after I left the Air Force and further investigation to that, we discovered a new relationship between time and energy that became the building block of what we're doing today.
Well, what did you discover? In other words, why was there this error in an absolute calculation? Do we now know?
It's a phenomenon of general relativity called frame dragging. What it means is that a massive body that spins has a tendency to twist time and space around it. Even a body the size of the Earth or the Moon. And when we came up with our new mathematical model, it accounted for it. We didn't know exactly how we did it. We knew we accounted for it and solved the problem. It took a few years for us to really understand what was inside.
Field, frame dragging?
Yeah, it's a classical physics term, frame dragging. It just means that a massive body will actually twist space and time to a very, very small degree around it. A body the size of the Earth or the Moon will twist it to a very small degree.
Now, obviously, the very large planets would, to a larger degree.
Yes.
And something as powerful as a black hole to an extremely large degree.
Yeah, and something like the sun. For instance, we know that if we look at the a radio signal from a distant quasar as it passes near the sun, or if we bounce a radio signal off a planet when it's on the other side of the sun or near the edge of the sun, we can actually measure the effects due to the gravitational effects of the sun. So it doesn't take a body much more massive than the sun or the Earth to see the effect.
So the sun pulls it, actually, doesn't it?
Yeah, it actually twists space and time around it. The element of gravity itself can dilate or change time. The fact that a massive body is spinning, it adds another small effect to that dilation that is called frame dragging.
All right, you know, I can buy that. So taking that as the basis of something that can occur, you've designed the time warp field generator, and you claim that you can actually achieve time dilation, using your phrase, with lower energy levels.
Yes.
How low, relatively, can you begin to see? Because after all, even though a planet may not exert a lot of pressure on time and space, you have shown it does exert some.
Yes.
How do you then distill this to achieve it at a lower energy level? Because a planet's got a lot of energy, after all.
Well, I'd like to go back and first comment on your question from Dr. Keiko, and I have a lot of respect for Dr. Keiko. His work is phenomenal. His view he presented is a very common view today, that time travel to actually control or alter time rates would take a massive amount of energy.
Yes, as much as the sun might have.
As much as the sun might have. It's a good, very accurate number according to classical physics. What we've done is in this model that was discovered when we were analyzing and solving the satellite position problems, we discovered a relationship between time and energy. And maybe I can explain it to your listeners a different way.
Okay.
We all know, as children, we've held magnets in our hands.
Sure.
And we know that if you put two poles together, sometimes they'll push away, sometimes they will attract each other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you hold them very close in your hands, it works fine. Well, what happens if you stand on one side of the room and you put the magnet on the other side and you rotate it around? It'll have no effect on the magnet on the other side. What happens if you take one magnet and put it in Los Angeles and one in New York? Obviously, it's not going to have any effect. Now, if you could build magnets that were, you know, extremely powerful, is it possible? Yes, it's possible within the laws of physics, but it's very impractical. Then you take the same time. So that's magnetism. Well, what about electricity or electric fields? When the first radio came, it was a simple spark that would transmit energy only a few feet. Could you do the same thing and use just an electric field to send a signal from Los Angeles to New York? The answer is yes, but it would take a massive amount of energy. But what we know today...
You mean an electric field? You mean, for example, the old spark generators?
Exactly.
They were gigantic electric fields, very wasteful, very broad, very powerful. They would do the job, but not really very well.
Not really very well. But as soon as, but when it was discovered that there was a coupling between an electric field and a magnetic field, what we call electromagnetic waves, which are your listeners, many of them are tuning into if they're not getting a real audio feed off your website.
That's true.
Once we discovered that, now I can take in my hand a small battery, a single 9-volt battery, put it in my hand and power a transmitter that can send electromagnetic waves millions of miles into space.
You're exactly right.
That coupling, as soon as it before, when there was just magnetism and electric fields, it was infeasible. Within the laws of physics, it would be possible, but it was not practical. That's what, all we've done is discovered a coupling, just like between electricity and magnetism, between time and different forms of energy that allow this to happen at a much lower power level.
All right, I understand the analogy. It's a really good one. You're absolutely right about that, but I don't understand the specific thing that you have done that has allowed this.
Well, the specific thing that we've done is we've created what we call a general relative. You know, when you talk about dilating time, people always talk about special relativity and general relativity, meaning that you can dilate time two ways that are accepted today, with very fast speeds or very heavy gravity. Our field is more along the lines of of a general relativistic effect. Essentially, though, you ask about the generator. We have an antenna configuration. We introduce this rotational electromagnetic field. It's very large. It's probably about 7 meters high, the antenna configuration itself, so about 20 feet. The time warp field generator itself, we have injectors that inject a gas reagent that help us create a very large amount of energy. When we initiate a field, we require a lot of energy.
And you're talking just about an electromagnetic field, right?
Yes, it's a rotating electromagnetic field. We set that environment up, we inject a gas reagent, and then we have a laser array of 12 high-power lasers around the core of the field.
Yes.
And we use those lasers to excite the reagent to create the amount of energy to open up the field. Once the field is opened up, the power on the lasers is pulled back a little bit. The rotational electromagnetic field becomes a less important component. Initially, though, the electromagnetic field is important to make sure we have a stable field.
And then all of this is, you actually have an antenna. You load this into some sort of radiator, some sort of antenna.
Yeah, actually, the antenna itself, we have 16 elements around the generator that help create the rotational field in a way that'll contain, contain the energy better as we open up the field.
What have you actually created? I understand you're using the rotating magnetics, you're using the lasers, and then you have created something, and you can back off the energy levels, and
yes,
the creation continues. What did you just create, Doctor?
What we created was, let's just say, it's an area within space where within that area, and it's a spherical field, within that spherical field is an area where time rates will pass slower or faster depending on how we set up the field.
Good Lord. What sustains this field after you've backed off your power levels?
Well,
in other words, you're into some sort of a creation here that I'm almost grasping, but I'm not quite there. What sustains this when you back off on the power levels?
Well, it's the sustaining part of it is not as confusing to us. Essentially, when we open up the field and it becomes stable, when we back off the power, the laser array we use, we modulate the lasers that are using to, you know, maintain, that we use to maintain the field. And we have an array, as I mentioned, of 12 of them around the field today.
Right.
They're used to control and keep the field stable. We have a gas reagent. Sometimes during a test, we have to actually re-inject a gas reagent into the field to keep it stable, but it's mostly primarily used to open it up.
But you've started something that you can then back away from and is self-sustaining to some degree, right?
Yes, it is. It's very self-sustaining. The only thing that maybe in some areas that we have some questions is when we create this field, it becomes a little confusing to us because we start not understanding what we see in terms of power levels. As a matter of fact,
all right, there you are. Doctor, hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour. We'll be right back, folks. Especially in view of what Ed Dames had to say, which was fascinating no matter what you think about Ed Dames. This is an interesting UFO photograph. Just go to my website, www.artbell.com. Go to the What's New area and click on, let's see, what does it say there? It says, New UFO Picture from a Digital Archive. Duh, shouldn't be too hard to get to, right? Take a look at that and let me know what you think. All right? Now, back to Dr. David Anderson, who's located way back east. Where are your laboratories?
Our laboratories are located in Long Island, New York.
Yeah. Interesting place, actually. A lot of interesting and sometimes worrisome research is being done on Long Island, isn't it?
Well, yeah, with I guess the Brookhaven labs here, and sometimes get a lot of attention for different things. But actually, it's a pretty quiet place.
What do you think about Brookhaven? I mean, is there the possibility, just very quickly, that they could push a button and we could suddenly have a minor bang, which would be all it would take?
I don't think so. Sometimes people ask us that about our facility. They're afraid we're going to open up a black hole that's going to destroy the Earth.
Yeah.
I don't think that's a possibility, actually.
Okay. All right. I want to go right back to where we were. We were talking about the field that was created, and then you're able, of course, once the field is created, to back off on power levels. And there is some aspect of this that you don't fully understand?
Yeah, that's correct. One of the things that I would first say to ask your listeners is not to challenge these ideas, but to challenge themselves a little bit. When you ask about the technical description, what we have is it's like a plasma field generator. This is a plasma field generator is nothing new. It's been around for a long time. What we found a way is that in the boundary area, the outside of this plasma field generator, the boundary area has a unique characteristic that it can actually isolate time rates. So time can move at a faster rate on one side, but move at an independent rate on the inside. And that's what we've done. There's many times a lot of mystique about this and a lot of doubt about the technology. One of my favorite objections is the objection that to dilate time or to change time rates, it'll take an infinite amount of energy. Well, let's go back for a second. Our research has shown clearly that time rates can be changed at a much lower energy level than,
yes,
than what's been said in the classical physics. Look at the other law that just fell only about 7 months ago, that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light. Well, guess what? That has fallen. It's been validated in labs all over the world that, yes, a wave can travel faster than the speed of light, and when it does, it will move in a negative time direction. Before, the theory was for anything to move faster than the speed of light, it would be impossible because it would take infinite energy. Now, a light wave has no mass, so there's not that type of energy, but mm-hmm. the concept that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light is a dead one. Now, all the textbooks will tell you differently, but
I thought your other analogy was very clear. The one that talked about, for example, a spark transmitter that's a blunderbuss making just noise all over all kinds of bandwidth, throwing it out all over the place, and yeah, you can get from here to there, but you've got to use enormous amounts of power to achieve it. And you pointed out you can take a little 9-volt powered transmitter on the right frequency and hear it on the other side of the globe. So, I mean, you're exactly right. I understand the theory of what you have done here. I don't understand, and I guess you don't fully either, what keeps that field going when you back away on it. That would seem to defy the laws of physics.
Well, what's interesting is, there's certain things we do understand. We know that inside the field, when we do certain things outside the field to modulate it, that we can create, you know, a certain performance, that we can accelerate time rates or we can slow time rates inside the field, actually make time move faster or slower. We know we can do that. We can reproduce it. It's very predictable. What we don't know is necessarily all of the whys. We also know that we see energy fluctuations. When we pull back on power after we open up a field, we know that according to the laws of physics that we understand that it should take X amount of power to keep the field open.
Precisely.
What we see is sometimes requiring more, but sometimes requiring less power. Now, that's what really fascinates us, because
Me too.
When we open up this field, well, either the laws of, you know, we have a field open that's being sustained at a lower power rate than our understanding of physics and our time warp field theory says is possible. So what does that mean? It means maybe our equipment is wrong, or our equipment is out of calibration or incorrect, and it's not. Maybe the laws of physics are wrong, which we don't believe so, or the laws of quantum mechanics,
but
we don't believe that either.
You can do it reliably, repeatedly, or you said sometimes.
Oh, okay, when I say that, what I mean is that we can create, when we create a time warp field, we can, I'll say it simply, we can adjust the time rate inside the field. We can speed it up, maybe to about a factor of 3 to 4 times the time rate outside of the field, so we can actually make time pass 3 times faster inside the field,
uh-huh.
or we can slow it down.
Uh-huh.
When we slow down too far, the field becomes unstable.
When you slow down too far, the field becomes unstable.
Yeah.
So does that suggest that ultimately time travel going forward is going to be easier to achieve than going back?
Oh, actually, that's a very accurate statement today. Even without any knowledge of our research or any of the other research going on around the world, yes, time travel in a forward direction is much easier and much more achievable today than time travel in a reverse direction.
Huh. All right, here's the next question I want to ask you. We'll leave the field for a moment, and let me ask you: how do you prove that you have accelerated or decelerated time? How do you do that? Within this field,
we've done it with I'll say three ways, and we're underway with our fourth way right now. The first thing that we did in 1997 and 98 was to do a lot of work when we brought our first time warp field generator online. It was small, but it was enough to do the first experiments. We were able to demonstrate it with clocks, reference clocks.
Okay.
1 clock outside of the field, 1 clock inside of the field.
Right.
And we were able to measure the time rate differences inside and outside of the field.
You're telling me you could actually see a clock in the field either running slower or faster than the reference clock?
Yes, and we did it both with not only with electronic but also with mechanical clocks as well, because a lot of people, you know, talk about the magnetic field effect on electronic equipment.
Sure.
That was our first demonstration, which was really our big breakthrough.
Okay, before you leave that one, how much difference in time could you observe?
Well,
not that it matters a lot, but because it just demonstrates it, period. But how much?
Let me introduce a term, because it's easier to talk about this way. If we have a field, outside of the field, we call the rate at which time passes the reference time rate. That's the time rate that we're seeing right now. Inside the field, we were able so far stably to accelerate the field, the time rate 300% inside the field, which means a factor of 3 times faster. Which means when 3 hours pass outside of the field, we can have, or when 1 hour passes outside of the field, we can have 3 hours pass inside. And we've been able to stably slow the time rate in the field down to about, I'll say about 35%, meaning that we could slow the time rate inside the field to that point, 35% of the reference time rate. So when 100 minutes pass outside, we can have 35 minutes passing inside.
Well, that's incredible.
That is the application.
That's absolutely incredible. Oh, my God. And so then when you take the clock out, there is, in one instance, a 300% difference, and you're sitting there looking at two clocks with that much difference?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Holy smokes.
In some cases, when we initiate the field, we have to... you can't always visually observe the clock inside the field. The field has a characteristic of Dopplering energy up or down, mostly because of the time rate and the boundary of that plasma field. When it does, sometimes the visual, I think everybody's pretty much familiar with the Doppler effect, the shift in frequencies.
Yes.
A time, when you go across a boundary layer that has a time rate divergence, it has the effect of Dopplering frequency. So sometimes, when we adjust the field, you actually see an object appear to its frequencies, including its colors, to shift, which means eventually they'll shift out of the visible spectrum. It looks like they actually disappear, but they don't.
Oh, my God. Really? So, in other words, at least visually, on occasion, the clock in the field to the eye disappears.
That's correct. That's correct. Matter of fact, a lot of people, we started a project when we first started this. We called it Project Dark Star, and everybody thought it was a sinister weapon of mass destruction. The reason we called it Dark Star is that one of the first things that we learned when we put an object in the field and we changed the time rate in one direction, the actual visible light would be Dopplered down as it passed through the field. So the colors would start changing, and then eventually the light signals, the color, the visual optical image of that object passing through the field would be Dopplered down so far up so far that it would actually disappear and the field would become black. And
how were you able to assure yourself, because it must have been a really big question, somebody standing there looking at this one, oh my God, look at that. And then the next thing would have been, you would have wanted immediately to know, is the object still physically there? Your answer is yes. How did you find that out?
Well, I think we know it's physically there. The answer is yes.
We're
virtually certain, I'd say 99% certain that the object is still physically there. One of the most interesting examples we do, we use a mechanical clock that involves a series of rolling and dropping metallic balls. And when we create that slowed time rate in the field, just before the object becomes not visible, you can see the clock, mechanical clock functioning at a lower speed. And you can see objects falling, these metal balls falling in the clock, actually slower. And noticeably slower than they would if you were holding them outside of the field. And again, it's due to the time rate divergence. And that's a real powerful, that's probably from an experimental standpoint, it's the most worthless experiment, but from an emotional impact, when people see that experiment, they freak out. Amazed, yes.
Freak out. I would. God, I'd love to see that. And then it virtually to the eye disappears. Would it disappear to a camera as well?
Absolutely. Because all it is, it's visible light. And actually, this Doppler effect is a huge, you know, problem we have, because you got to remember what we have. We have a 12 laser array firing into this field generator.
Right.
Okay. It Doppler's energy. You know, our laser energy, when we are accelerating the time rate field, when the laser energy hits the boundary layer, that plasma field, I'll call it a plasma field.
Yes.
It's Dopplered up, which means very quickly it can get to ultraviolet, and eventually gamma radiation, harmful radiation. So when we accelerate time rates and we have a living organism inside the field, we essentially are putting it in a radiation cooker when we try to go too fast and accelerate time rate. And doing that more stably with lower power is important to us.
All right, that was the first experiment. Now, I'm going to sidetrack you for just 1 second, because,
sure,
again, I'm blown away. I have this character, Dr. Anderson, out in KCMO territory, about 25 miles from KCMO, our affiliate. And I've got to tell you, I called him Madman Markham. He was a young fellow who tried to make a time machine. And you know what he did? He eventually went out and stole a whole bunch of power company transformers, all right?
Okay.
For which he went to jail. I mean, I talked to his parole officer. The guy actually stole these transformers, hooked them up backwards to create this gigantic voltage, put together an electromagnet affair, and modulated it with lasers, and claimed that he was going to be able to time travel. He had actually thrown, I forget, a screw or a nut through it or something, the first model he made, and the damn thing disappeared and then reappeared. Now, this is a wild-ass story. I admit that. But it starts to sound an awful lot like, or at least close to, some of what you're doing.
See, now, that's interesting that you say that, because, you know, you're right. On the surface, it sounds like a wild-ass story. Now, people say our experiment is like the technical description of the Philadelphia, it's absolutely nothing like it. We're using lasers to create the energy, not the electromagnetic field. We're more similar to a plasma generator than a magnetic field, a pure, simple magnetic field. But what you're describing that Madman Markham did has much more correlation to what we're doing.
Well, again,
it's interesting. He sounds like an interesting person.
Oh, he was a very interesting person. Why do I say was? Because, as I said, he lived 25 miles outside Kansas City. I had all kinds of contact with him. He had rented a warehouse, had purchased a bunch of, some of my listeners helped him. He got these giant transformers. He was making this gigantic model. And for a mystery, we've never heard from the guy again. I mean, he's flat gone. It's been years now. And that's exactly what he was working on, these giant magnetic fields modulated by lasers. And I couldn't resist. I mean, it just sounded just like what you're doing.
Maybe he'll show up one day when you least expect it.
He said that. And I thought that when he walked through this thing, he would either turn into so much ash, or maybe he achieved what he was trying to achieve. The guy had cojones.
Do you know that's our biggest problem too, is that when somebody steps into something like this turning into ash, when we did our testing on living plant organisms and bacteria, one of the problems that we've had is,
was that number two?
That was actually plants were number two and the bacteria was number three, but the biggest problem is that we're putting so much energy into this We have to be very careful, or we create a radiation cooker, which is very harmful to a living organism.
Yeah. Well, when you tried it with plants, and then you said an organism, what happened?
Well, what was interesting, when we first did their experiment with plants, you know, we have a spherical field. Initially when we started our experiment, only those seedlings that were located at the very core of the field survived the experiment. Now, as we get better and better with the field, you know, when we did our first test, we used a set of seedlings that had a very predictable germination and life cycle, and we were able to demonstrate, you know, the acceleration and slowdown factor, but we also at the same time destroyed 90% of the sampling of seedlings that were inside the field almost in every experiment.
But in the 10% you did not destroy, what were you able to demonstrate?
We were able to clearly show that that we were able to alter the time rates. The species, I can't remember the name of the species, the Latin name for it, but we have consultants who help us with this, had a very, very predictable germination cycle and life cycle. What we're able to show in that the samples inside the field versus the samples outside of the field experienced a much greater time rate and a shorter life cycle and vice versa.
I take it because acceleration is easier than the reverse, that you would accelerate them, it would be your best demonstration. So, in other words, a seed put in there versus the control seed outside the field would be well into germination?
Yes.
Holy mackerel.
You know, actually, accelerating time rates in our tech, not just when you talk about high-speed rocket ships to the future, it's time travel to the future is easy. Accelerating a time rate is easy for us. The only limitation we have is the amount of power that we're putting in. It's so high that, again, when we accelerate time rates too much, the upper limit, we can accelerate time rates inside the field as fast as we want, but at 300% there's enough energy that it's going to kill any living organism inside of it. At 200%, 250%?
Now, do you think, since you're constantly working on ways to refine this and therefore use less energy, do you think that ahead there's going to be a way to use less energy, achieving greater effect or more time dilation?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, in our first time warp field generator, a short story, had a field size of only 3 to 4 centimeters. When we moved the field size from 3 to 4 centimeters up to 30 to 40 centimeters, we cut the amount of power needed for that 10 times larger field by a factor of 10. So we increased the field size 10 times, but we cut the power by 10 times because we learned more.
Holy smokes.
Now,
all right, listen, we're at a break point here, Doctor.
Okay.
Hold on, we're at the bottom of the hour. Do you believe all of this is going on right here in the good USA, good old USA, right in on Long Island? And we've got the man who's doing it, Dr. David Anderson. So you might just be hearing something new tonight. Are you surprised by what you're hearing? Intrigued? I am. Stay right where you are. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right. I can't resist. Dr. David Anderson doing a fabulous job tonight describing his research, laboratory research ongoing right now. Dr. Anderson, are you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. Here's this curious guy who's still awake after having a invigorating, hormone-producing debate in the first hour. Richard C. Hoagland.
Oh. Well,
hey,
I'm
Richard.
Up working on a new book.
Yeah, all right.
So?
All right. So a couple of questions, right?
Yeah. Dr. Anderson, I heard you about a year ago when you were on Art Show the first time, and I tracked down your website through Keith Links, and I couldn't really find any specific information. And tonight's interview, you're providing a lot more details, but the thing that I want to know is, have you ever heard of the work of a Dr. Bruce De Palma, brother of the famous director Brian De Palma, a physicist, who about 20 years ago was duplicating, or actually you were duplicating what he did, replicating very similar phenomenon with purely mechanical rotating systems.
What exactly did he do, Richard? What was
involved?
Well,
he basically took a record changer turntable, standard, you know, one of those old Victrola types.
Right.
And he put it under, with proper shielding, an FM receiver. And he rotated it at 33 RPM and 78 and 45 and all that. and found that there was a distinct frequency drift that went away when he stopped the rotation.
You mean a Doppler shift?
No, there was a frequency shift in the received frequency of primary stations on the dial. Well,
that could be described as a Doppler shift.
Well, a Doppler would be if there had been motion, relative motion between...
Well, you've got motion, though. You've got the turntable going round and round.
But there's no... In other words, you don't have a motion between the receiver and the turntable. The turntable sitting under it, you know, kind of like right angles. Anyway, that was one phenomenon.
All right. Have you heard of that work at all, Doctor?
You know, no. Have I heard of similar work? Yes. Have I heard of Dr. De Palma? No. The similar work I've heard of in the former Soviet Union, they did a lot of work with a small metallic rotating cylinders half immersed in water and trying to, I mean, there's many, you know, attempted documented papers out available on the internet and other sources about some of that work, but I'm not familiar with Dr. Palmer now.
Okay.
His other experiment was he took a Bulova Accutron watch. Remember those?
Sure.
With a little tuning fork?
Yeah.
And he did the same thing. He had it shielded so there was no electrical potential problems. And when he rotated it, the Accutron would change time. It would change relative speed. It would slow down. He was not of these experiments able to accelerate the phenomenon much as you're reporting tonight, but he was able to retard it and compare the Accutron after the run. You know, I forget what the numbers are. They're available on a website. The actual stuff is published. I can email you the links tomorrow so you can take a look at it. But it was significant, and I've been trying for years to get some folks to replicate it, because it demonstrates that one can interfere with this energy relationship we call time at much lower energies than the standard guys like Kaku and others think is possible.
All right. Well, listen, Richard, thank you.
Well, there's one other one.
One other one, okay.
The most interesting one is the biology, because he put ordinary lawn grass on top of the turntable. The lawn grass was stationary. There was a metal shield to shield from electrical effects. The turntable rotated at the 33 1/3 RPM for several days, and the control experiment in a dark room with ambient light so there was no phototropic effect had a similar gadget sitting, you know, still with grass growing over it non-rotating. And the grass growing over the rotating turntable grew in a very particular geometry and faster and farther than the grass in the control.
All right. Richard, as always, thank you, my friend. We'll do a whole show soon.
Excellent.
All right.
Richard, it was nice speaking with you.
All right. Well, so some of that does kind of sound like some of what you have done, although using a different plan.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is I'm more, in some ways, I show my conservatism more from the classical physics world, but what always amazes me in the former Soviet Union, many facilities, many research centers were doing work with mechanical systems to accomplish time dilation. And I got to admit that I'm not an expert on the mechanical end of systems. I can talk more about classical physics from the electromagnetic relativistic.
All right. Again, your first experiment involved clocks, and that was very dramatic. The second one involving seeds and plants, very dramatic. And what was the third and the latest?
The third, we've been working with different strains of bacteria, trying to we've demonstrated on a living plant organism that our field, other than the 90% kill rate, can actually accelerate a process in a living plant organism. Now we're moving on into a single-celled organisms and different types of bacteria. We have not made a very controversial point with us surrounding us. We have not made, nor do we intend very soon to make a step to vertebrate animal testing, which is a big move. That's something that's not on the horizon probably for at least a year or two.
You know, that's really interesting. There's a great deal, it's very controversial, of animal experimentation that goes on. Why are you hesitant yet to give it a try? I mean, after all, just an animal. I'm taking a position I don't believe in. I'm just throwing it at you. Why is it not irresistible for you?
Well, it is. What's interesting, it is very, very tempting to us. First off, we know that we can produce we can produce performance, repeatable performance and results inside our field. We know we can do that, but we don't understand all the reasons why. Like I said, sometimes we don't understand why it requires less power than we expect it to. We
right.
also have that
right.
the risk to living organism. We would like to understand more about why the field does what it does. Why does it, when we slow down the time rate, why does the field collapse and kill these living these plant seedlings? You know, the reason why the plant seedlings are damaged is because the field, the boundary of the field actually collapses, so the core of the field becomes much smaller, and any plant seedling outside of that smaller core gets cooked, or is damaged, whichever way you want to look at it.
So you don't feel you have sufficient control of it yet?
That's one. First off, I want to understand it better, and so does everybody on my team. Second off, we already have enough attention in different groups who think that we as a human race should not be experimenting with time, just like with genetics and cloning and nuclear power, even though that's an older story. There are groups that protest. If we moved on to vertebrate animal testing without...
Yeah, I know you'd be in trouble.
We would just be... We're already...
But those who say you shouldn't even be investigating this area, they're full of it. What do they know?
Yeah. Well, you know, the benefit of this technology for good applications, everyday applications, is it really is staggering.
Well, could this ultimately lead, in your opinion, to real time travel? And by that I mean I hop in a chair surrounded by this field that you now have under control in some years, and I can actually go to... 3 years away, three years hence, I'll pop out on the other side, and I'll be 3 years in the future.
I think eventually it will be seriously possible. I there's no reason why it wouldn't be possible. However, I think in the next 4 or 5 years, the applications that will be seen will be more using time-controlled fields to accelerate research, medical, using a time warp field to slow down a disease progression or for disease treatment.
Sure.
Is probably the hottest area that that we have attention and are doing research on right now.
Okay, fine. But you're not ruling out what I just said.
I am not ruling out what you just said. There's no matter of fact, if any of us, it's kind of for us, it's the holy grail of space-time physics to be able to actually jump into a field and
okay, doctor.
Either way into the future.
Okay, doctor. If I were to do that, and now we'll enter the realm of speculation, having specified that, if I sat in this chair in the field and I went 3 years into the future, what would you see in the chair after I left?
What would be seen in the chair after you left? At that rate. When you went into the field, this, I'm talking purely optical now, I'm not talking about moving into a parallel universe or anything like that. Purely optical, if we accelerated that time rate field, we would see the field become black, and essentially you'd disappear. We wouldn't be able to see you. The field would have a very opaque appearance.
So I would now, for all intents and purposes, not exist in this timeline.
I think physically you exist in this timeline, but essentially you move forward 3 years, but maybe you move forward in the 3 years outside of the field, maybe only in 2 days inside the field. So in your time you pass 2 days and then you come out on the other end 3 years later.
Where would I land in 3 years, assuming that you still had, the seat there, I guess I'd land in the seat.
Yeah, but
if your lab got in financial trouble and they put a shopping center in, what would happen to me?
Well, being that you're still in the same physical universe, you're just inside a field that is blocking the optical path because of the Dopplering. I'll make you a promise, Art. If you jump in the field and we have to sell the lab, we'll make sure we turn the field off and let you step out before we just.
I know, but still, in all. If the field were to stop, I would be instantly back, or could I go to the future and stay there?
No. The answer is once you move inside that field, Once you're inside the field, an object that experiences a faster time rate,
yes,
is moving through time faster than outside,
right,
or slower time rate. If we put you in that field and retard the time rate, so in 2 days, 3 years passes on the outside,
yeah, yes,
you're going to come out aged 2 days.
Do you remember the H.G. Wells Time Machine movie?
Of course.
Okay. Do you remember when he pushed the lever forward, he saw things racing by him. He saw events, of course he went very far into the future, but things raced by him. If Art was sitting in the seat and you had the field going, what would Art see? What would you guess that Art would see?
First off, I think you would see nothing while you're inside the field. You would see nothing through the boundaries, again, because of the Dopplering effect. Anything that was visible light outside of the field, initially, if you were moving, if the time rates were only accelerated or slowed down to a small degree, you could see through the field boundary. We can do that today. But if you're talking about putting a person inside a field generator that size and accelerate them so they can move forward or backwards in time, you're really talking about a Dopplering effect that's not going to allow you to see any visible light through the field.
All right, as the technology presently exists.
That is correct.
Okay, but all right, then let's reduce it down to a smaller acceleration. If I were sitting inside the field, not cooking to death,
okay,
and I was able to see outside the field, what would I see? Would I see you moving very slowly, or would I see you moving very fast?
Okay, it depends on which way we accelerate the field, but in one case, yes, you would see the motion outside of the field being slower, like when we do the mechanical clock with the dropping metallic balls.
Yes.
And the other hand, you would see objects moving faster and people moving faster outside of the field.
Huh. Do you think that's all, you really believe it's all within the realm
yeah,
of?
Actually, we're demonstrating it today, and there's really nothing extreme about this. The real extreme thing will be, can we slow down time rate inside the field? The answer is absolutely yes. Can
yes.
we speed it up? That's the easy part.
But
can we reverse time inside the field? That is something we do not know if we can do. We do not know that yet. We know that we can put, we believe that the technology will allow putting a living person or animal inside the field and to slow the time so that while years pass on the outside, only a few days or a few minutes eventually will pass on the inside. So essentially you move into the future without aging. But what we can't do right now is we can slow the time rate like that, or we can speed it up so you age faster than outside, which I don't think most people would want to do. But we don't know if we can actually reverse time yet.
Okay, but how about this? How about the future, when your technology is refined, when the power levels are much lower and time dilation is achieved with a 9-volt battery,
okay.
And could I conceivably take a field with me? And I guess what I'm asking is there any way you can conceive in the future that a human being could move from whatever year they're in now to several years or many years in the future and keep a stable field with them, keeping them there?
Oh, well, the answer is once you're there, you're there. Okay, in the case of the field, if you're inside our time warp field and we slowed the time rate so that only 2 days would pass while 3 years passed outside,
yes.
When we turned off the field, you're not going to go back. You've only aged 2 days. I mean, this is pure classical relativistic physics. You've aged 2 days while everybody in the world around you has aged 3 years. When you step out,
uh-huh.
That's it. You're there. You're there 3 years in the future, having only aged 2 years over 2 days over the 3 years.
Uh-huh.
The field, maintaining the field is not an issue. It's not an issue at all.
So I could wait until interest rates got real high, go buy a CD, have you suspend me for a while, just age a few days, come out and collect all kinds of interest.
Now, there you go.
Awesome.
You know, there's an experiment I haven't thought about trying yet. Actually, we have many, many ideas along those lines, but we better not go there. Actually,
I don't mind going there at all. I mean, as stocks, for example, a little risky. CD is a pretty sure thing, right?
Yeah.
So there'd be ways of profiting from such a technology. There would be, right? What else have you thought of?
Absolutely. Well, you know, honestly, in our heart, you know, we all sit around and we joke when we have the time, which we have very little of.
Mm-hmm.
We really hope that the first fielded applications in the next few years are going to be in research, medical research, or medical treatment. Probably not medical treatment because we have to move to vertebrate animal testing, which is going to take about 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the application of our technology to help the medical, the search for, in medical research for new cures and treatments for diseases, has a tremendous amount of potential.
Well, in that area, just as an example, wouldn't there be great benefit to reversing time so that a disease that had progressed to a certain level could be, in essence, regressed?
Yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, that's the one of the biggest areas, and this is really, I got to tell you, 60% of our research is based on refining the technology and developing it so it can be used for this. Initially, it'll be used in medical for accelerating cure times in research, in test experiments for, you know, development of cures and treatments for diseases. Eventually, though, the hope is that you will actually be able to use it on a living person for the stasis or the regression of a disease.
Yikes. And you know, why haven't you been on Good Morning America? Why haven't you been on the Today Show? Why haven't you been on the NBC Evening News? 2020?
Yeah.
I don't know. All of them.
Actually, believe it or not, we have been on NBC. We have been in the Wall Street Journal. We do keep a little bit of low profile. Actually, this year is an exciting year for us because we will be bringing all of our research public before the end of the year.
How are you going to do that?
Well,
big press conference, that kind of thing?
Well, the first thing is a lot of our early work is available under Freedom of Information Act. I think many of your listeners know how to find that.
Oh, they do.
And they can look up some of the early work prior to 1988.
All right, Doctor, hold on. We're at the top of the hour, and we'll be right back. But remember, folks, when you do hear that big press conference, just remember you heard it here first. This is Coast to Coast. AM. Good morning, everybody. My guest is Dr. David Anderson, and we're talking about time travel. Practical, real time travel. Has that occurred to you? It's absolutely fascinating. And you may recall several years ago, a man who makes time machines sent me a time machine. I have one, and I have one component of it that I want you to see. Now, this component consists of a thing that weighs about 5 pounds. I mean, this sucker is really, really heavy. It's an electromagnet, and it plugs directly into the wall, 110 volts. It's a big electromagnet. His premise was, you take this magnet in conjunction with the rest of his machine, and you place the electromagnet on your chest and plug the damn thing in. Well, it's an electromagnet, all right. It's gigantic. And if it were sitting on your chest, I'm holding it on the webcam. If you'll go to my webcam photo right now, I'm going to leave it up there tonight. You'll see me holding this electromagnet. You can see the cord on it. I have never plugged it in, nor have I used the rest of the machine yet. I've always been afraid to, because this would create, and he even admitted it gets very hot, creates a gigantic electromagnetic field directly on your chest. And I've always wondered whether that was really a good idea or not, you know? So I've never really had the guts to plug it in and put it on my chest, or put it on my chest and plug it in, I guess, in that order. But I wanted you to see the electromagnet. I'm holding it in my hand. If you'll check out, if you go to my website and you click on the left on program, you'll see Art Bell Studio Cam. Take a look at that photograph. Take a look at that electromagnet. Would you put that on your chest and plug it in? I don't think so, as Ross Mitchell would say, but you might. All right. We'll be right back with Dr. Anderson. We're going to go to your call shortly. Dr. Anderson, by the way, has got to I don't know, fly somewhere in the morning, and so we'll have him only here for this next hour, I fear. You're taking off for someplace, right?
Yes, I have to leave here about 6:30, so to head for the airport.
Doctor, you have a videotape. This is something new from, what, a year ago when we talked.
Yes.
What is this videotape? What's in it? It's called Time Travel, Journeys into Time.
Yes, it's a new video documentary, completely about time travel. I guess the best way to describe it is we tried to challenge people to think about time and time travel by taking them on a journey through the entire history, including the real science of time control technology, time travel itself. We started with the early beliefs about what time was. We talk about time from the standpoint of philosophy, religion, ancient views, even touch on art, but really move very quickly into the science and technology and a lot of the new groundbreaking research is being done all over the world today.
How about your research? Is that in there?
Yes, it's included. Actually, we have more detail on our research in that video documentary, and like I mentioned, this year we're planning on really taking a lot of our research more public than we have in the past.
All right, let people know how do you get it?
Yeah, well, as a matter of fact, one of the things I wanted to mention, if your viewers are interested in, we have our association's website is at www.time-travel.com.
Oh, we've got a link up already.
Okay, great.
But how do you get the tape?
The video itself right now is available. It's just been released. It's available for purchase through our website. It'll be in distribution in your local video stores and
really?
On the major major online video shops probably within the next 4 to 6 weeks, depending on where you buy.
No kidding.
Absolutely.
So there's no 800 number to call?
Not right now, no.
Too bad. All right, so... Yeah. If somebody has a computer out there, they can go to my website right now where we've got a link. Just jump right over and you can order it online. And if they order it, how soon are they going to get it?
It's available. It's in stock, available for shipment right now. So typically within 4 to 5 business days.
All right. Well, then you're going to get a lot of orders. I hope your website is sturdy.
It's our website now gets on the order of several million hits a month. As a matter of fact, after your show last year, we were motivated to move to a high-volume server.
Yeah, we motivate a lot of people to do that, actually.
You know, we were quite impressed last year. Literally, seriously, we did. We moved to a high-volume server after your show last year because, unfortunately, we crashed once as a result of all the traffic you brought.
Yeah, we teach lessons in bandwidth. All right, listen, I've got a lot of people who'd like to talk to you, so let's open the line and see what we get out there. How about that?
Okay.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. David Anderson. Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Where are you?
Mount Healthy, Ohio.
Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. Dr. Anderson, I was curious. I caught earlier part of the show, and you were talking about your plasma generator, and I was wondering if it requires an MHD reactor.
An MHD reactor?
Mm-hmm.
No, it's when I said a plasma generator, it's like a plasma generator. Typically what we do is we use a rotational electromagnetic field in an open air environment. We inject a gas reagent into the center of the field, and then we use a laser array to excite that. Now the combination of the laser array modulating the different 12 lasers and that electromagnetic field help us establish and open the field. It is like a plasma generator.
You're just ionizing a gas field.
To create the initial power required to open the field, yes, you could say that simply is that we're using that to ionize it, if you want to say that. The reagent is used mainly to generate the amount of energy we need to open the field. It's not your classical plasma generator where you're going to have a big... the large iron core, cylindrical core, with the heavy electromagnets, it's not the same type. The general approach is the same.
Your control system, it seems to me it must be a very interesting control. I was kind of wondering if you're employing a SQUIDS interface with any of this.
No, but you're right. The control interface is probably... When you look at our research beyond the theoretical and some of the experimental applications that we're doing, one of the most complicated parts of our system, honestly, is the control. I mentioned that we had six injectors around the field. They're actually injector sensor arrays. I'm trying to think if we have an image. We might have some images of that on our website. You might take a look there.
Young lady, may I ask you a question?
Yes.
How do you know enough to be asking these questions?
I'm a physicist.
Great. Good answer.
Great. This is good. It's good. I enjoy these types of conversations. Yeah, essentially, on every injector sensor array, each of the six, we are pulling in 43 data points. And one of our biggest challenges is that our stability, when we retard time rates inside the field, keeping the field stable is difficult. We try to do it with brute force. We read in 43 data points from six injectors. You can do the math. We feed that into our control system, and then we in turn try to modulate the field real time. And it's one of the biggest challenges we have right now because we cannot keep the field stable. We feel we could modulate it faster, that we'd be able to maintain the stability. So what we've done now is we're trying to, instead of take those 43 data points, we're looking for key characteristics in that data stream and data signal, and we're trying to use those instead of the entire data stream to modulate the field.
I have two more questions, if that's all right.
Go.
One of the questions I had is, are you seeing any residual field diffusion in any of your temporal bubble models or field models?
Okay, when you say diffusion, I can interpret that a couple different ways. When you say the field did diffusion,
do you see the field spilling over or becoming unstable at specific parameters or
yes.
Interfaces?
Yes, absolutely. And actually, this is the biggest area. As a matter of fact, I'd hope if maybe possible, if you have some experience in this area, you might send an email off to the side. But it's our greatest challenge right now. When we begin to across that boundary layer, when we create a retarded time rate on the other side of the layer, when we retard, that's where the field gets unstable, and we don't know why.
Hmm.
What happens is, typically, let me say the boundary of the field has an outer diameter and inner diameter. What happens is, when we retard the time rate so far, we get fluctuations in the inner diameter. When we get that fluctuation in the inner diameter, it essentially collapses when we retard the time rate mm-hmm. too much. And that Doppler effect that is typically constrained in the thin boundary layer of the field now is extended across a wider area of the field closer to the center of the core. And when our samples are inside the field and they're exposed to that part of the core, that is where they're damaged. They're damaged by the Doppler effect. Because anytime you have a time rate divergence, when you look at it, and you have a time rate divergence across a layer of space, it also has the effect of Dopplering both in an up and down direction depending on which way you're going and where you're modulating the field. And that's what we don't understand.
You're using just standard interferometric methods in controlling this? Or is it a distributed system or a smart system or using fuzzy logic?
No, it's a distributed system.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fuzzy logic. And we have on the injector sensor array, six of them. We have six points outside the field where we use interferometers.
Okay.
You know what? She sounds like she ought to be working for you.
And you know, I'm you know, actually, in a way, I don't mean to use your show to look. One of the things that, you know, our background and on our staff here is all, you know, classical physics, classical mathematics. When you brought up, and I'm sorry, your listener, your name was?
Ann.
When you brought up the issue of the stability problem, we feel we're treading in an area that maybe we don't have the experience on staff, whether we don't know, we've actually even employed some chaos theory experts to help us understand. We know what the results are inside the field. We know what we're modulating on the outside. We just do not have the mathematical model that shows why the field goes unstable.
The mathematical model isn't that difficult, and you can probably derive it from duality theory of manifolds.
Caller, do you think you could contact him privately?
Sure.
It sounds like it's a marriage made in heaven.
Hey, I'm falling in love here.
I hear you. Ann, thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you so much.
Take care. Holy mackerel.
I like that call.
I wasn't ready for that one at all. All right. Wildcard line, you're on the air with Dr. David Anderson. Hello.
Hello, Art. Dr. Anderson?
Yes, hi.
Hi, this is the Zen Man calling from Anchorage, Alaska.
Okay.
I had a comment about the definition of time,
okay.
or what time is. For years now, I've been meditating, and I've noticed repeatedly this phenomenon for about the past 20 years. I'll call it frozen time. It's when a clock, if you keep a clock just outside of your vision, Doesn't matter what kind of clock, mechanical or digital. I've noticed repeatedly that the second hand will freeze. Now, the very moment that you become aware of this, of course, it starts moving again. Now, I've noticed doing this meditative practice called Qigong, which is a control of the heart rate, which might be considered the basic organic measurement of time.
Yogis do that, yes.
Okay. I might be approximating some level of Satori, which might be considered to be the timeless state where the individual's in direct contact with the collective unconscious. And I wondered if Dr. Anderson had any comments.
Well, we're moving into the metaphysical a little bit, but it is a kind of an interesting question in view of the setup he did on the nature of time as well.
Right, it's a non-mechanical based time effect. And I think it would kind of play into the theory here a little bit.
Well, I tell you, my first reaction is for listeners, and it's surprising to hear me say this because I wouldn't have said this 6 years ago. I believe that eventually the ability to travel or transcend time, if you want to put it that way, will not only come from a technological solution, but also from probably from within the power of the human mind. And what your listener is saying here is very consistent. As I mentioned earlier, you know, Buddhist monks will tell you that they don't understand why we think that time moves when in fact it stays where it is. And in that philosophy, I don't mean to bring in karma, and I'm not an expert here, but the thought is when a person transcends karma and can achieve that pure state, that time, past, present, and future all becomes one, and they can see and transcend all time as being stationary and standing still.
Caller, I think he's agreeing with you.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much,
and take care.
Sorry, Art. That was a little bit of a long-winded response.
No. That was just fine. I thought he was going in a wrong direction, and then it all came together for me there. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. David Anderson. Hi.
Hi, I'm Stephen.
I can barely hear you.
Yes. How you doing, Stephen?
Your name is Stephen.
David.
David.
In South Carolina.
Okay.
I was wondering within the parameters of the device where you're finding trouble on the low end of digression, have y'all tried any pulse alternative to try to stabilize? And I'm wondering if within the usage of the device at some point in the future, would it be, maybe this is theoretical, I don't know, but would it be any type of device being able to put it one location and one or the other to use in a transportation.
Oh, okay. That's enough. Let's hold it right there. A pulse to stabilize. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, actually we do that today. When I talk about modulating the field with our laser array, we do have a pulse configuration employed today.
All right.
We're still experiencing many problems with stability when we retard or slow down the time rate.
All right. What about transportation from one physical location to another, not just through time, but through space, obviously, as well?
Well, what's interesting is, and people are surprised by this comment, the approach of our technology today, as we understand it, does not allow that. And many people, that puts a contradiction in their mind, but...
Well, a lot of people say, here's something a lot of people say. They say, look, the Earth moves in an orbit around the sun. The Earth rotates, right?
Yes.
So if you move somebody in time, have they not moved in space? And in fact, the globe has turned while this has occurred. So wouldn't there be a physical displacement?
Yeah. Actually, the classical time machine from H.G. Wells' movie, The Time Machine, fails for that reason, because if you did have an object that was stationary and moved through time, when you returned, the Earth would no longer be there.
Yes. There you'd be in the vacuum of space.
Yeah, and many people apply that model to what we're doing. Understand what we're doing is completely different. What we have is a contained field, and we're adjusting time rates inside. We're not requiring movement through space to accomplish the time dilation, or we're not claiming to have the classical Wellsian time machine, if you say. But essentially, because we have a field and the time rate divergence is created inside of the field, wherever that field moves, that object is still inside that field. It is still there.
Very comforting. I mean, you just wouldn't want to pop out in a complete vacuum with enough time and breath to say, damn. Yeah. And that'd be it.
Exactly.
All right. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. David Anderson. Hello.
Hey, Dr. Anderson, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine tonight. How about yourself? Thank you.
Oh, not bad. Yeah, I wonder if you could explain to me, physics just fascinates me, and this program is pretty interesting. I just wanted to know if how you could explain how time 2,000 years ago is like the time present today. Or did I misunderstand that?
I'm not sure of what you just said.
Okay, you said that the explanation for time, that there was no explanation for time as far as some parts of physics.
Yes.
Could you explain that to me?
Well, if he could, he would have answered the question when I asked him. The answer is, I think, that he cannot adequately explain that, and I don't really know anybody who can.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It fascinates because, I mean, it goes on. The day goes, you know, and
yes.
And so time must be happening as far as the sun rises and it goes down in the west.
Yeah, very good. That's exactly how we measure time, right,
exactly.
Doctor?
Yes, that's a good question, but I guess I would challenge your listener to put him to the test. Okay, so we all know what time is. We see it every day, so we understand it. So what is it? What is time itself?
It's got to be just a day-to-day thing.
but that's insufficient. It is day-to-day. Yes, the sun, we go round, the sun comes up, sun goes down, and we measure.
Mm-hmm.
But is that the totality of time, or is that just sort of our understanding of it as we physically tool around on the planet here?
Well, thank you very much for enlightening me on that.
I'm not sure there was a lot of enlightenment there, but at least we've got the questions right.
I'm just a little confused, and I'm
all
kind of confused.
We're all confused. Don't worry about it.
It's a really interesting subject, and I'm all ears.
All right, indeed. Doctor, hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. All of my favorite movies are time travel movies. And you must know that Wanna Take a Ride came straight out of Contact with Jodie Foster. We'll ask about that kind of time travel here in a moment. My, I love this topic. Absolutely love it. And I've got several good questions for the good doctor in a moment, so let's get going. All right, back into the abyss we jump. Dr. David Anderson. Dr. Anderson, here's a kind of an interesting speculative sort of question, but talk about a breakthrough. Mark from Canton, Ohio asks, Doctor, could you eventually, as you refine your process, send future research data back in time in order to accelerate your own progress?
Well, the answer to that question is today. Today, understand what we do is we can speed up or slow down the time rate in the field. We have not been able to reverse time in the field. So someday, if that was possible, maybe yes. Today, we're not sure, and we're a little bit skeptical whether the technology will actually, this particular technology applied, will allow a negative time, allow a negative time rate to
would
say information to the past.
Would that answer the paradox question? You know, the go back in time and kill your grandfather or your father or something or another, and poof, away you go. In other words, the paradox is in fact a hard rule, and you can't do that because you can't travel back in time.
I don't believe that. I really don't believe that paradox. And the reason why I would say that, many of your listeners might be familiar with what's called the Tipler cylinder. Frank Tipler, back in 1974, published a paper that showed how reverse time travel to the past is possible using a certain approach. Now, granted, it was very extravagant. It was a large rotating cylinder in space involving a spaceship with tremendous technical performance, but it allowed, physically, it was the first proof that showed time travel to the past was possible. So is it possible within the laws of physics to travel in a negative time direction? Absolutely, yes. So I think someday that will be achieved, and the issue of the grandfather paradox might fall away as being only really just, again, one of those places where our rational mind bumps into its own limitation.
But are you able to help me out at all with that? In other words, if you could travel back, why, what would prevent you from causing all this time havoc?
Technically nothing. Technically nothing would create you from having that time creating.
So in other words,
havoc.
as you can take a revolver and put it to your head and blow yourself away and cease to exist in all practical ways.
First off, if it's through relativistic physics, a travel in a negative time, if we accomplish that using relativistic physics, then there's no reason why you couldn't travel to the past and alter the past. Now, there is some speculation that says, well, if you do travel to the past, you'll end up in a parallel universe, in a version of reality that's separate from the other parallel universe that's running on where you didn't go back.
So you won't disturb the timeline, the main timeline.
Yeah, that in fact you're affecting now a parallel timeline that is branched off in a different direction. So that's one explanation of a possible answer.
Gotcha, for the paradox. Did you see the movie Frequency?
You know, no, I have not.
What? You haven't seen Frequency? You've got to see that movie right away. You must go rent that movie right away.
You know, I'm sure I have it on our shelves in our space-time museum, but I don't think that I have not seen it. No,
trust me.
Sure.
Trust me. See the movie. The question is as follows. Perhaps before we're able to actually physically travel in time, and this comes from the movie in a way, would you imagine it to be possible to communicate through time?
I believe, yes, I do. I do. I believe that across long distances of time, if I can say it that way, yes, that communication, especially communication to the past, would be achieved prior to actually sending mass to the past, meaning, you know, a person, a ship, or something like that.
Yes, because of the problems inherent in biological transfers.
Exactly.
All right. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Anderson. Hi.
Hello, how you doing?
Okay, sir, where are you?
Greetings from Chicagoland.
From Chicago.
Yes. I had a question for Dr. Anderson, and by the way, I've only been listening for about a week now, so it's great to hear something out there that actually is along the same lines that I think about, Art. Dr. Anderson, on the actual field that you said you generate, that it's a circular field, have you had any experiments when you put something in it, say, that goes into the field and out of the field at the same time?
Something extending right through the field.
Exactly. And say, like a solid object, does the field stay, does it just affect one part of the object, or does it actually encompass the entire part of the object?
Good question.
Okay. The answer is that it does not engulf the entire object. But moving things through a field is something that we learned that we don't do. First off, if it's a living organism moving through the field, you're passing it through the boundary layer where all that time differential is being absorbed, including that Doppler effect, which means we pass a living organism through the boundary layer of the field. Once it's set up, then that living organism is going to be destroyed, guaranteed. With regards to material objects, I mean non-living material objects, we have put objects in the field. We get some strange effects, but nothing that would you know engulf that entire object in the field. It pretty much has no effect.
I see.
We have run signals back and forth in and out of the field, both optical and through conductors in and out of the field. And the results we see are very, very predictable.
I see. I'd wondered because the caller earlier had asked about traveling kind of through time, and this goes towards a warp, like a warp drive, if you will. If you have something that can actually encompass that field where you get some particle off of it, it actually could go through time kind of as a warp drive almost. That's why I was wondering that.
Yeah, we call it a time warp field because we slightly twist time. I mean, maybe we
right.
should, we probably shouldn't have used the word warp in hindsight, but that was 13 years ago that we put the label on it, and now it's stuck. So
I understand.
All right,
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. David Anderson. Hi.
Hello.
Hello there.
Hi. Hi, Art. Hi, Anderson there. I was just wondering if you've tried this. I know you said you're having a problem, with the Doppler effect there. So that's basically your harmonic problem you're having. Is that with the stability of the lasers, basically, is what you're having a problem with?
Well, what happens is, you know, the boundary layer of the field always has a Doppler effect. But when we slow the time rate, the thickness of the boundary layer expands into the core of the field. So typically the Doppler effect is constricted to the outer shell of the field. When we retard the time rate or slow down the time rate and that boundary layer becomes thicker, it collapses into the core and basically anything inside the field, most of it can be exposed to the Doppler. Typically we like to keep it on the outside where it's away from the samples or instrumentation inside the core.
I see. Are you familiar with how our CRT cathode ray tube works? The color with the it's under vacuum and you have three electron guns shooting
sure.
through. Well, have you ever simulated or tried doing this maybe in a vacuum or probably in zero gravity effect?
Hmm. No, we have not. We have not done it. We have not done it in a vacuum, and no, we have not. We have not speculated about doing it in a zero gravity effect, mainly because it's not practical due to the size of the equipment and the power required.
One other thing is, do you create a large enough field to actually put a video camera camcorder and reproduce the field and then play it back and see what it sees?
Yes, we actually in the current one that we've done, we've put target objects in with a small digital recorder, and we pulled them out. We had some problems in certain areas because of the interference with the camera, but it showed that the object is there in the field, even though the boundary layer of the field is opaque. When that field goes opaque, is it really there? Is the camera and the object really there, or is the camera and the object really somewhere else? I guess I can't answer that.
Have you, well, then you've taken an operating, say, video camera to the point where it begins to disappear?
No, well, when the camera is inside, we put a very small digital camera and recorder inside the field with an object, a target object, in front of the lens, and we showed that as we retarded the field or accelerated the field, And we saw the opaqueness from the outside, is that the video was pretty much undisturbed except for some interference, minor interference. So the question was that camera still seeing the object inside the field when we started the field? The answer was yes. So they're still there somewhere.
So prior to doing that experiment, what did you expect to see?
Exactly that. This is really all the results we've seen are like a general relativistic effect, and I don't mean to throw it out that way. Pretty much what we see is very predictable. The only thing that's not predictable is what happens in that thin boundary layer.
Gotcha.
We still don't understand why everything happens there.
All right.
The way it does.
East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. David Anderson. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I have done a lot of research on the internet, and I think I may have an understanding of how gravity works, and I wonder if this may have some relation to an understanding of time. My understanding basically assumes that the fabric of space and time, the ether, does exist, that the force of this ether or zero-point energy is stretching the fabric of space and time equally in all directions, except when it is in the presence of matter. This is so because matter attracts the zero-point energy in towards itself, sustaining itself, and in this manner, the fabric of space and time is significantly distorted around a massive object. In a massive body system like the Earth and Moon, there's less zero-point energy pressure in between them. Basically, I believe that gravity is a large-scale Casimir effect. If this is so, Dr. Anderson, I would like to know what you think about this explanation of gravity and if you think that this flow rate of time, or that the flow rate of time, could be related to zero-point energy.
Okay. There's probably three responses in there. The first one, does a mass in space distort space and time? Absolutely, yes. I mean, that's I accept that. That's that would be part of classical physics. Absolutely, yes. Does the second half of that with regards to zero point energy? I mean, obviously, I'm a little bit familiar with some of it, but I'm not an expert on Nikola Tesla's work in that area or other people's work in that area. It's even sad because I'm sitting here on Long Island where many of Tesla's facilities were. but I'm not familiar with that. There are many similarities between with regards to the mass distorting space and time around a mass and space. Absolutely, yes, I agree. With the other ones, I'm probably not qualified to answer.
Well, if you could look at a single atom inside your field, what would you see? How would you say that the field actually affects this atom? Is it at the stage of the parts of the atom, the particle parts, the gluons, muons, and so forth, or would it be on the electron? Or I mean, it's got to affect it in some way.
I agree. Yes.
Well, actually, it's a good question. But remember, we're talking about, and you mentioned gravity, and when I talk about a general relativistic effect, this is a whole theory about how gravity can affect and dilate time. When you have a field like this, or let's take the simple example of the high-speed rocket ship where you have somebody traveling out into space, coming back 10 years, and the Earth has passed 1,000 years.
Right.
That individual and his biochemical structure and his perception of time and his life and his body and his living organism have not experienced anything different. His atoms have not been altered. His electrons, his subatomic structure is still the same. His evolution of himself as a living organism has not changed any differently than if he was on the Earth for 10 years, assuming that all the gravitational issues and all that are the same. So the answer is no. We don't expect, nor do we see, or expect any changes in structure, cellular structure, or atomic structure. In the boundary layers, it's a totally different story. All bets are off there.
Yeah, Art.
Yes,
can I throw in a philosophical comment here?
Yes.
I think it's appropriate. In thinking about the idea of parallel universes and time travel and a lot of the other stuff you see on your show, it makes me wonder if we and all of the created universe is nothing but a complicated and intricate computer program/hologram that exists inside the mind of God.
Oh, let's just use the word matrix. And
matrix.
All right?
I like that word.
All right. Thank you very much. I don't know. Maybe we'll all find out shockingly one day. Was for the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. David Anderson. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, I have several questions. I don't know if you'll let me ask all of them.
Well, I don't know if I will either, but go ahead and try.
But I am a kid who listens to your show all the time.
How old are you?
I'm 13.
All right, first question is, why are you up at this hour?
Because I've been wanting to talk about the moon thing, but since that subject's over.
No, it's not. We're going to do a final hour of open lines. We'll talk about that and time travel.
Okay.
But you have a question for Dr. Anderson.
Yeah, I am a long time fan of time travel, and now that I hear that science fiction is actually coming true, I was just wondering, when will this be out to the public?
Okay.
Well, actually, we've released some information to the public. Like I mentioned, there's been several different publications. Let me throw a few out. If you check the Wall Street Journal, Fox Television is going to be bringing back a show called In Search Of, and they're actually going to be showing some glimpses inside and outside of our laboratory and some information about our work that'll be airing next month. Our public release, also under Freedom of Information. You can find some early work prior to 1988, and within the next 2 months, we're going to be releasing and making public a new research paper that talks about some of the power problems we've been having with the field. But it's going to give a complete overview of the current status of the time warp field technology and our understanding of it. So
the answer to your question, caller, is some of the information is out there if you know where to look, and he just told you. Listen, caller, thank you. You're right. We don't have a lot of time. But I want to ask this, doctor. How much do you know that you can't tell me? Proprietary information. How much information is there that you can't discuss on the radio?
Well, there's certain things. Obviously, we have clients who fund some of our research, and we do research for them, and we have confidentiality agreements. That's straightforward. I assume more you'd be talking about what aspects of the technology and performance we can't talk about.
No, because that would you couldn't answer that. Are there aspects of it that you can't talk about?
I'd say it this way. The answer to that question is yes, there are aspects that I cannot talk about, and obviously any time you have research of this nature, what is released publicly is typically a generation behind what is really going on.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Well, that says a whole lot. Gee, we can all wonder where the next generation is that's going on right now. Oh, my.
Well, right. This is going to be a fascinating 2 years. I mean, when you look at what's going on, if you want to talk about the Time Travel Research Center at all, one of my biggest passions is people really need to take a look at what's going on with our understanding of time. I mean, it is being turned upside down. Within the last 2 years, there have been at least 4 or 5 significant events that have totally, validated new views of time, but sometimes we just race through life and we don't see these things.
That's right. Well, let me plug it for you again. There's a new videotape, Time Travel, Journeys into Time. It eventually will be in your video store, but if you can't wait, and I know I can't, you can go to the doctor's website, which is linked right now on my website, and you can actually order the tape right there. How much is the tape, by the way?
The tape is $39.
$39. That's not much money for a good grasp of an understanding of time and a glimpse into the lab where you're working. And you do get a glimpse in?
Absolutely. Get a glimpse and a summary of our technology, an overview of our performance, our system configuration, and many other details, too. It's a complete exploration into the nature of time and time travel from 20,000 years ago to the latest groundbreaking technology.
Doctor, I hope you can get a little sleep before your flight. Boy, has this been a good program.
Thank you, Art. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, my friend. Good night.
Good night.
Time travel. And I'll tell you. Anyway, listen, we're going to do open lines when we come back, and that young fellow who I had to cut off is welcome to call back and talk about whether or not we went to the moon or time travel or whatever else is on anybody's mind out there. Open lines when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell.